the Ursus Claws.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Age of Darkness podcast. As usual, I'm JP, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Stormcast Eternal Mark.
So how are they coming along, anyway?
Oh, good. Very good, actually. Yeah. Super easy to paint. It's actually nice.
Really? It's a nice little break?
Yeah. I'm not trying to make them... I'm not painting them to the same quality I paint my Space Marine stuff, but, you know,
they're fun. Just paint them gold and give them a couple washes of sepia. Yep. You're good.
Sepia? Hell no. Black. Black wash.
Really? You do black wash?
Yeah.
You don't find it it dulls down the gold?
It does, but you go back over and you burnish the gold up a little bit.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Anyways, in this episode of the Age of Darkness podcast, we will be discussing... This is the first of our three-part series on the Conquest campaign system from Book 4 Conquest. We've mentioned it before. It's a really cool system that not a lot of people seem to be using, and I think it looks a little impenetrable and complicated when you just look at it. So we're going to try to break it down, explain how the thing works, and I try to encourage people to use it and try to encourage ourselves to use it as well. So it's first of our three-part series on the Conquest campaign system. After that, we will be jumping right into book club, and we'll be talking about Mark's favorite book, Vulcan Lives by Nick Keim. And then we will end, as usual, with 2-week hobby challenge and a bunch of bantering at the end. Couple things to get through at this at the beginning of the show. First off, we apologize. There's just going to be several apologies at the beginning. Most of our show is going to start with a bunch of apologies for what we did last time. So first off, apologies for everybody that tried to download our episodes the last couple times and kept getting the like error 429, or on iTunes it just wouldn't download, like failed downloads. We were going through some growing pains in that we were using Google Drive to host our podcast, to like host the podcast file for, you know, the first like several months of our show, and it was fine so long as no one listened to it. But now we have a lot of people listening to the show, and what winds up happening is when a lot of people try to download at the same time, way more than should. I don't understand, but anyways, when a bunch of people are trying to download the show at the same time, it throttles Google Drive, and it can't find the file. So that's why you get error 429, file does not exist. It's because Google Drive is completely throttled and it can't do it. It's growing pains. So we had to deal with that issue. So we had to move over to a paid service, but that is okay. So from now on, we are going to be hosting our files on SoundCloud. I looked at all the options that seem to be the best for what we're looking for. It's got unlimited space, and since we're putting out a lot of stuff, I mean, that's pretty important. And we should be good now. There should be no more error 429. There should be no more problems downloading. If anybody does have any more problems, let us know, because we want to deal with the issue. The last thing we want to do is piss off all our wonderful listeners, and who are the only reason we do this stupid show. So, once again, we apologize for anybody that had trouble downloading the last couple episodes. It shouldn't happen anymore. And that, you know, might as well mention it now. Go check us out on SoundCloud. Other quick apology. This one is more about sound quality. Last episode, we had some issues during the book club segment where we were discussing with Kenny from the Combat Phase podcast, which was a really fun discussion. Unfortunately, we had some audio problems. I think it was mainly my crappy internet connection. And we had a lot of audio clipping, and the sound quality wasn't very good. And I actually had to cut out a little more than I would have liked from the discussion. I cut out like all the bits that were really bad, and was hoping that what I was left with was decent. We still had some audio problems, and I'm hoping it wasn't bad enough that it bothered people that listened to it. And I'm really, really apologize to Kenny for that problem. So we're gonna solve this problem and have him back on the show for another book club to make it up to him, because we pride ourselves on putting out a good sounding show, and that did not sound good. Also, Mark, get a new mic.
Yeah, but when you drop your phone and you break your phone, you got to get a new phone first. So
I don't understand why your phone's a priority over getting a new mic for the show.
Because I use my phone every day.
Yeah, but it's not for anything important. I know you. Okay. I think that does it for the apologies. If there's anything I forgot to apologize for, let me know.
Well, you are Canadian. Well, we are Canadian, so we got to apologize for whatever. Who cares, right? So.
Yeah, but I'm also French, so I can tell everybody to fuck off. Mange la merde. Okay, as usual, like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes, send us an email at ageofdarknesspodcast@gmail.com. Our Skype response line is Age of Darkness Podcast, and you can find it through my name, JP. It should be in there. So send us a Skype message, and we'll play it on the show. Join the Heresy 30K forum, because it's an awesome community. Yeah, I think that's it for... Oh, yeah, SoundCloud. Check us out on Soundcloud. Very excited about this.
I think you already said SoundCloud, but it's good to remind people.
I got to remind people that we're on SoundCloud now. People like to stream, and now you can stream. Okay, what's next in the intro segment? I hope everybody checked out our Battlecast. It was... We took a while to get it out. I know we promised it, like, beginning of August or something like that. It took a while to get a decent game in, like, get the whole thing recorded and edited and play around with the format, but we finally put out our first Battlecast. For those that don't know what that is, we just recorded a battle report, but, like, a really in-depth one, because a lot of people were asking us to do battle reports, and considering the way we do our show with Book Club and everything, we don't really have a lot of time to do, like, an hour... battle report in the middle, because we're going to end up with a 4-hour show, which is something I'm trying to avoid. So we just made a separate show for it. It's not going to be every 2 weeks. It'll be from time to time. Hopefully people find it entertaining.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can do it every 2 weeks.
I think it's fun to do. So we want to do more. I had fun the first time. So let us know what you think of the format. And this is pursuant to the Battlecast. Don't forget to log on to Auz30K.com, AUS30K, and join our war, join our front of the Global Heresy campaign on Arkalask Septimus, the armory world at the edge of the system. That's where we will be doing our Battlecast, where we'll be logging our games. So log on some games, create an army. Get some battle reports in for Arkalask Septimus, and help us try to catch up a little bit to Greg and Tim and Michael, because we're getting left in the dust. And speaking of other people's 30K podcasts, Mark, there's big news in the 30K podcasting community. There's a Fourth Horse Heresy podcast that just came out.
Wicked.
And it's about time. So one of our listeners, actually, Sean, he started... started his own show with his co-host Splane. It's called the Seize the Initiative Podcast, which is a great name. Why hasn't that name been taken yet?
I think in the past there was a Seize the Initiative Podcast, but it tanked.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, this won't happen with this Seize the Initiative Podcast. I guess the focus of their podcast will be pretty much army lists and more tactics and strategies, which is something that we don't do that much.
Well, their first episode is them mostly discussing the meat of the show, is them discussing tactical Marines. And it was basically they're describing how they're having they were originally having an arms race with their sergeants, which is pretty awesome, actually.
I don't know, man. Sergeants should be Power Axe, Artificer Armor. That's good. That's what you need. Melta Bombs.
That's a pretty good loadout, yeah.
No, I don't know. That's my standard loadout. But we listened to the first show. It's great. Really heartily recommend them. It comes with the Age of Darkness podcast seal of approval. And best part is finally, some Americans are on board. I was always confused that it was, the UK was represented, Canada was represented, Australia was represented. But the Americans were slow to get on board the 30K podcasting community. So now some Americans are on board. A little late to the party as usual. But as was the case with the last two world wars, I mean, they showed up eventually and it was pretty decisive. So let's hoping that that the Seize the Initiative podcast is decisive. Great show. Keep it up. Can't wait to hear some more, and really heartily recommend everybody check them out. Last thing I want to do before we jump into the meat of the show is plug our competition. Because don't forget, we're running our 30K on a budget competition. Already have a bunch of entries, so I'm really pumped about that. I was hoping it wasn't a situation where the one person that sends his list wins by default.
Yeah.
So we got a bunch of entries. I just want to remind people what the rules are. Mark, do you remember what the rules are?
Has to be entirely 30K resin from Forge World. Has to be a Legion Crusade list. And I can't remember the day we're supposed to.
It's got to be a 2,000 points Age of Darkness list. Standard
Force Organization. I guess that matters a lot.
Yeah. Standard Force Organization chart. You need to make a 2,000 point army. You have 520 pounds to do it. It has to be in Forge World resin prices. And you have until midnight Greenwich Mean Time, October 3rd, 2015, to send us your list. And the winner will receive the awesome Master of Signals and Legion Champion set. As a first HQ choice that you buy, I think it's the best. We had a couple questions that we should probably address. First off, we were asked if the Legion Pravian was acceptable. Yeah, so since his model is, I guess, limited edition, or you can only buy it at shows, that's fair. Legion Pravian is fair, so long as we have a price tag on it. And if you want to use something that's not released yet or something like that, just we need to know what you're using as the model, and we need to know how much it costs, like what the cost in Great British Pounds is. So yeah, Pravian is fine, Delegatus is fine, anything is, Davenite Priest is fine, the Navigator is fine, but we need to know what the model is and how much it costs. So that's the main issue. That's the whole goal of the exercise anyway. What's the other question we had?
A question about using plastics. Not the, obviously not the upcoming release, the Heresy game, but using things like drop pods and rhinos and I guess Land Raiders as well, things like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this one. I said specifically it's got to be Forge World Resin.
Okay, but that sort of restricts what people want to build.
Okay, explain. Like
if someone wants to play an Orbital Assault and they need drop pods, well, Forge World doesn't make regular drop pods.
Well, they make Dreadclaw drop pods.
They do, but those aren't necessarily dedicated transports for your guys to take.
Yeah, but if we open the door for some plastics, we're opening the door to all plastics, aren't we?
No, we could be restricted. Why not?
Okay, well, how would you restrict it to be within the rules of
drop
the
pods, that's it.
Is there any other unit that would cause a problem?
Well, you can get rhinos from Forge World. You can get Land Raiders from Forge World. So
it's just addendum to the competition. You're allowed to use plastic Games Workshop drop pods so long as you're using Games Workshop prices in pounds.
Perfect.
You sure we're not opening the door to a bunch of problems?
No. We'll stick to that. Remember, we reserve the right to change anything at any time. So
yeah, but I don't like doing it.
I know, but...
All right. You're allowed using Games Workshop plastic drop pods, but that's it out there. No more. No plastic, except for that, because I guess you don't have a choice if you want to run an Orbital Assault. And yeah, we don't want to restrict what people do with their lists. And I suppose if you sent us a list already and you want to add drop pods to it, just get a hold of me and we'll fix it. Don't worry.
We'll dock you points, though, if you use plastic drop pods.
We're not going to... There's no points! We're just going to pick the list that we like best through our incredibly opaque rules, decision making.
So okay, well, much I love drop like, pods, though.
You love drop pods?
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. not necessarily going to win if you had a bunch of drop pods. It's okay, it's the list, the winning list is going to best combine fluff and power. That's how we're going to decide. The best one is if someone wants to get into 30K and he wants to do it on a budget, we could throw this. This would be a good starting list that is incredibly thematic, and you won't get your teeth kicked in game after game, because that's not fun for anybody except for me for some reason.
I'm sure there are people that don't mind.
Yeah. Is there anything else that we needed to mention about the competition?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Anyways, all the rules, I'm going to make sure that the rules are clearly posted on Facebook and clearly posted on our blog, which is Age of Darkness Podcast .blogspot.ca. But it's probably easier just to look at through Google. But if you have any questions, just send me an email. If you're not sure about the rules, if you're not sure about anything, send us an email at ageofdarknesspodcast@gmail.com. We'll get this thing sorted out.
Do we have them posted on Facebook?
Yeah, they're posted on Facebook.
Okay, cool.
And I'll make sure that I'll make sure to keep them near the top at all times. I'll keep updating them every week or something like that, so people can see the rules.
Okay, cool.
Is that good for the intro?
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's a long one. Okay, there was a lot of stuff that we needed to deal with before getting into the meat of the show, but no more boredom out there. Let's talk about some cool stuff. So we'll be right back for what's new.
All right, and we're back for the new stuff from Forge World over the past 2 weeks. And we got a few things. Want to start with the least cool thing?
The least coolest thing, which is the Dark Angel stuff?
No. It's the Knight Sion seated. Come on. Don't make me slap you.
So they put out, a sitting pilot that you can throw into a knight. I guess it's only the Sarastis knight, so you can't put that into a regular GW knight?
I have no idea. I don't own a Sarastis knight, so...
Yeah, I think it fits in. Yeah, they made a pilot that fits into the head of the Sarastis Knight.
I'm sure you could put this in a regular night, but just 15 pounds for something that people aren't going to see very much. I guess if you want to paint it, sure, but it just seems kind of silly.
Why?
I don't know. Well, why do you want a seated guy?
So that, you know, the head can be removed and you see the pilot and everything. No, Mark, it's not just a game, eh? There's also a major aspect of modeling and painting that I particularly enjoy a lot. And this is something that I would probably buy.
You're making it sound like I don't enjoy modeling and painting.
No, I'm not saying that. It's just that, like, you say, oh, well, people will never see it. And it's same. You glued your Reaver Titan shut. You didn't even do the interior detail. I love interior detail.
Oh, I just can't be bothered with that, to be honest.
No, that's your call, but don't.
Like the head is fine. Like I have all the guys set aside when I do the head for. I don't need to glue that shut. But just the inside, I don't know. Just doesn't do anything for me.
I think interior detail is great. The one thing that bummed me out about the Warlord Titan was the carapace didn't open up. I wanted to see what was inside.
I was surprised that there wasn't. It didn't bum me out, but I was just surprised that they didn't actually do any.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it was costing. Like at a certain point, I mean, is it really worth making it another 200 pounds more expensive to add interior detail?
Yeah.
I love interior detail. I think that this is something that I would get if I got a Strassus Knight. I love this stuff. I mean, I read like military modeler magazines and everything like that and see the work that they do on like how hard they work and just making things look cool. I mean, if you're making a display piece, like something that'll also function as a display piece, I think the Knights are really good, the pilots are really good purchase. I think it's cool. I think it's cool release. I don't think that's the most boring thing that got released. I think it's really cool. And I know it's expensive, but I would probably get one. But once again, you know, it's you don't have to like it. Okay, so can we get to the really boring thing, the Dark Angel stuff?
Actually, I was going to talk about the Tagmata army list.
Well, Tagmata army list, that's actually huge. I don't have my copy yet, which sucks.
It is really cool. Like 32 pounds, you know, it's the price of a regular codex here in Canada, so.
Yeah, it's a good value, but all the red books are fantastic. Now, there are a few modifications. Now, look, we don't have it in front of us yet. We can only go by what I've been told on the internets. But apparently, a lot of units are getting price adjustments. And do you remember a couple months back, I was talking about Castellax getting more expensive?
Yep.
Yeah, well, once again, I am prescient because apparently the Castellax are 20 points more expensive now.
Okay.
Which I think is fair. So that'll make him 105 points, I believe.
That's not fair, but whatever.
No, I mean, they really need it to be more expensive.
They totally need to be more expensive, but more expensive than that.
Yeah, I was thinking they were going to get boosted up to maybe 120 points, but no, 105, that's still expensive when you start arming it. You give it an enhanced targeting array, now you're at 120. You give it a couple flamers, you're at 130. Frag grenades, 135. So the cast lacks that I like using with my Pravian, that's going to be 135 points.
Yeah, that's still really cheap.
It's still pretty cheap, yeah.
At least it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, but I don't expect them to get another up to get more expensive than that. But it is necessary. Castellax were, with Tactical Marines, the most price-effective thing in all of 30K, I think. Castellax were just brutal they were 85 points, which is ludicrous.
Yeah, so, yeah, well, the Mechanicum list in general is probably the best list out of all of Heresy.
Yep, and that's why in the competition we said you couldn't use the Mechanicum list. It's too easy.
So you're saying it's like an easy button?
It is an easy button. No, Mechanicum isn't necessarily easier, but they are. If you're talking about like power levels, they are at the top of the pack.
Yeah, well, that's actually something when I was listening to the Forge the Narrative podcast, because they started to jump into the Heresy, that's the list they immediately said that could compete in 40K tournaments against like Eldar and Necrons and things like that.
Yeah, but who cares about 40K tournaments?
Exactly.
So yeah, I think also Ursarax, Thanatars, and maybe the Destructors, I think they all got a little more expensive. I'm not exactly sure.
That's weird. I don't know why the Thanatars would get more expensive. They're already really expensive.
Well, what I would have liked is, I don't know, I'm waiting to get my hands on the book, but what I'd like to see is a reason to take the Calyx. I think it's a cool model, but I don't see the point of it.
Is that the last cannon one?
Yeah, that's the last cannon one with the grav hammer.
Yeah. Did it get cheaper?
I don't know. It really, really would need it. Either that or, once again, I just wish you'd give the grav hammer to the standard Thanatar, but whatever. But once again, okay, we're going to do a full review of this once we have the book. These are just some impressions that, or some stuff that that people have mentioned online that we are yet to confirm. But if the Castlax and a couple other units got a points increase, I think that's good. We're going to have to wait to do a full review on this. But as generally speaking, the red books are amazing. They're incredibly accessible. I love my big, thick volumes, but you can't bring them to the game store, you know?
Yeah, I'm always wondering why they haven't done digital ones for people yet.
It is baffling. What I do is my big volumes, I've actually photocopied some of the important parts because I'm not bringing them to the game store anymore. I'm not because of fucking mouth breathers with their Dorito fingers touching my $120 book.
They're like, let me see your book.
$150 book there. Oh, man, no, people don't know how to open a book. Like, you don't have to fold the page completely to turn it. Anyways, I'm not doing it anymore, so I photocopy the relevant bits for personal use only, of course, and I'm not bringing my expensive-ass books to the game store anymore.
That's a good idea. That's why I like the digital stuff, because I don't have to bring my books, and people aren't, you know, grabbing at it.
Honestly, I'm baffled as to why there's no digital copies yet. I guess they're worried that they're going to get pirated, but I have a feeling that's happening anyway.
Well, it is. As soon as there's a digital copy release, usually within a day, there's a pirated copy of.
Yeah, so why not put it out so the people that actually want to buy it can buy it?
Exactly. I'd buy all of them right now. It's just with the way the dollar is here in Canada, paying $140 to $150 for a book right now is just sort of out of the question.
Yeah, with shipping and everything, my copy of Tempest cost me almost $180.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is I want to get Tempest because I want the Night List and I want the Solo Auxilia List, but I have a feeling they're going to do a Red Book for it.
That's Conquest. I think there's no – the Night List not in the Tagmata Red Book. I thought that the Night List would be in there, but apparently it's not. But all the Knights except for the new GW stuff is there.
Yeah.
Which is weird, eh? The new – like the three new Games Workshop Plastic Knights, they're not in the Tagmata book apparently.
No, when they do the Red Book, I imagine they'll slot them all in.
So you think there's going to be a Knights Red Book?
I don't know if it'll be a book just for Knights. I imagine they'll double it up with something. But they could do a whole... I mean, Games Workshop, a whole book on Knights, and there's only five Knights, so...
Or maybe, you know what? Maybe there'll be a book with just, like, Auxilia lists. So there'd be Solar Auxilia, there'd be Imperialist Militia and Knights. Like, all the separate, like, smaller lists.
That would be pretty cool,
actually.
That'd
be a cool book, actually. I wouldn't be surprised if we'd see something like that. Anyways, this isn't a rumor. This isn't anything. This is just pure speculation. But I think that would be a really, really cool list. So it'd be like the Imperial Exertus and Knights Red Book. Both the Militia and the Solar Auxilia are part of the Imperialist Exertus. Anyways, Imperial Army. I could see that happening. That would be a good way to get around the problem.
Yeah,
you need to put out the Red Books. Those the regular Horus Heresy books are just way too big and expensive and precious to use as army lists.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
I think it's
a great release. I love the Red Books, so.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's going to be amazing.
Also, another thing I should mention, once again, I don't have it in front of me, but I've looked at the contents, and it says Mechanicum Tagmata, but there are adjustments. Apparently, there is a part where you can use Reductor or Cybernetica. They're both in there. It's just they use a master list from the Tagmata, which is, I think, that's not surprising.
So what do you mean? They're not going to do what Games Workshop does and release Codex Mechanicus Scutari and Codex Mechanicus Cult Mechanicus?
No. This book is good for all three Mechanicus. And I think everybody now has access to the Mechanicus Land Reader. I'm not sure about that. Yeah, anyway, moving on.
We got the Mechanica Magos Macro Tech Engineer and Servo Automatas. What do you
think
of them?
A great set. It's a really cool set. Love the model. It's almost old school. It looks like it could have been put out in metal. You know, it's all like, it seems like a one piece.
Yeah.
But I think it looks really cool. I love how it comes with Cyber Automata. Is it Cyber Automata it comes with?
Yeah, Servo Automata.
Yeah, which look awesome. I'm liking how they went with a sort of a Silax look to them instead of like making them look like standard servitors.
I think it's really cool.
Yeah, and it's not too expensive too for like a whole unit. Because I would have expected that stuff to come separately, but I like how it comes together, and I think it's a really cool set.
Pretty cool. It's just a bright, like, I don't know. It seems a bit expensive to me.
I don't know. You're getting five models
for $90.
Well, £45. No, it's way worse than that. I mean, these are pretty, I mean, these aren't just like Space Marines. These are actually really cool models. Well, Space Marines.
You don't think Space Marines are cool models?
I think they're cool models. I mean, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying it's got everything. You get five Marines and you also like throw in all like, you know, their bolt guns and everything like that. It comes pretty expensive too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really cool. I like it a lot. I was actually thinking of picking one up to get some servitors.
What do you need servitors for?
Well, in 40K, I like to run Tech Marines. I have no servitors because I don't like the Games Workshop ones, so I'd like to have some.
You can also get those tracked guys from the Mechanicum list.
Those guys are?
Are they pretty big?
They're huge, man. They're on 60 mil bases.
Oh, shit. Okay, never mind.
Yeah.
I thought they were smaller than that. I thought they made good servitors. Yeah, I love the Macrotech kit. I think it's a great kit.
It's pretty sweet. So on to the awesome news.
The Dark Angel stuff?
Yeah, Dark Angel stuff. I'm super happy about this.
Are you going to pick any up?
Well, I'm trying to decide that right now because I've already deckled up all my guys and the Legion symbol is different. So I'm not sure what to do.
It's not that different. But well, yeah.
This is the same symbol they use on their like all the tank doors and all that for the Dark Angels.
Okay, what's the difference? Is it the broken sword?
Broken sword and wings are, I guess. Well, I guess since, you know, they're 3D here, they're a little bit different. But I don't know. They're just really cool looking. I'm not sure what to do.
I would do nothing. I would just wait for decals to come out. And if you decide that you like the new decals better, just put a new decal on.
Yeah, that'd be a lot easier than popping off all the shoulder pads and cheaper. Yeah.
I don't know. It's really your call. What do you think of the heads and bodies, though? Heads and torsos. I mean, dark shoulder pads are fun, but I prefer my Warlord Titan.
Well, the heads. I like the heads, actually, because they have more. But they have the whole set here, too. Because the little one we got the teaser of, it only had one of the heads and didn't look too cool. But they're pretty nice. I like them. Some of them, a couple of them, like more than the other ones. But, you know, you're not going to ever get a whole pack of the same one from Forge.
I think they look awesome.
Yeah, that would actually be something easy to do if I really wanted to pull the heads off my guys.
I don't know if it's worth pulling the heads off your guys, but when you get more, when you start adding to your army, like adding more legionaries, then maybe you want to start mixing in some of the new bits.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, because right now my force is entirely painted, except for one model at this point. But I was thinking for anything new that's coming out, when I want to get more squads, or if I have to, you know, see what their right of war is, when I start picking up more models, probably picking up some heads, some torsos.
I would just outfit another 10 breachers and mix them into your squads.
Well, I'm slowly getting together with making a new breacher squad, because I'm getting the new knight kit comes with this really awesome shield that you like mount on the side of it, and it almost would be perfect for little knights of Caliban, I think.
Cool.
So I'm slowly acquiring those from people.
What about the torsos?
I like the torsos. One of them I like way more than the others. I wish you could just get a set of that one, but...
Which one is that?
The one that looks like knight plate mail armor. If you're looking at the picture, it's the one on the top left.
Oh, yeah, that is cool.
Because the other ones are cool, too, but that one's just much better than the others.
Because that's what I would do if I were you. Just add a little variety in your squads, get another 10 men, and just mix those into the squads that you have right now. Or you can make veterans.
I'm considering it, actually, because we're going to be done this year's 3,500-point challenge, so I'm trying to pre-plan next year's.
Are you ever going to add tactical Marines to your army?
I have tactical Marines.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't recall you having tactical Marines. I thought you use, like, 30 breachers exclusively.
No, I have 10 tactical Marines, too.
Oh, okay. Well, look at me learning stuff.
Oh, yeah. I played them against you 3 times in a row.
That's possible.
Killed a Castellax, man. You can't remember that?
I thought those were breachers.
No. Breachers were killing other things.
All right. Sorry. I forgot about that.
That's okay. But yeah, definitely. I'm thinking of doing that. Maybe, I don't know, picking up a few here and there and just doing some neat conversions.
Yeah. All in all, though, as a Dark Angels player, are you satisfied with this release?
I am satisfied. Okay. I just wish I hadn't painted everything so I could get some of these shoulder pads.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do?
Exactly. I'm not going to hold back.
As far as we knew, there was never coming out. I mean, Forge World has been laughing at this all, laughing about Dark Angel shoulder pads all year.
Who wants to play Dark Angels? Seriously,
they are a silly legion. They're a silly, silly legion.
Definitely. So that's everything that's new.
Wicked. Some great releases as usual. I'm pretty pumped about the Red Book. I like how they made some adjustments. I won't feel so bad. Like, I run Castlax. I love my Castlax, but I won't feel so bad putting them on the table now because they were. just way too cheap for what they for what they did. I like how they got a little points boost. So, another great series of releases.
Wicked.
All right, so let's move on to the more meatier discussion. We are going to be starting our series about the Conquest campaign system. We'll be right back. All right, we're back to talk about the Conquest campaign system from Book 4, Conquest. Now, this isn't new. Conquest came out last Christmas, so I'm sure a lot of people have gone over this. We haven't, and honestly, I think it's really relevant to talk about this because I find not a lot of people are using this system, and it's really cool.
It's the best system that's ever come out of Games Workshop for a campaign.
It's amazing, and I think one of the reasons a lot of people aren't using it is that it looks a little impenetrable when you just go over it real quick. It's like, yeah, this seems complicated and maybe not worth it. So what we're going to try to do today and for the next two episodes is going to try to break it down and explain how the thing works, explain how you can build your Conquest campaign system and try to get people to use this thing because it's awesome. So today we're going to be discussing the basic rules, rules of how to run a Conquest campaign. In the second part of our series, and in the next episode, we'll be talking about all the added stuff, all the extras and optional rules that you can sort of add on to your campaign system to make it more interesting and up the complexity a bit and give it a little more flavor. And then in the third of our series, Mark, you and I are going to sit down and we're going to build a campaign system. We're going to build our Conquest campaign and to show everybody how it works, like how you do it.
And hopefully we can play that.
Yes, well, awesome. Of course, that's also part of the goals. Mark, what are your what's your general impressions of the Conquest campaign system? What's your overview?
This is an amazing system. Nothing like this has actually ever been released by Games Workshop or Forge World before. Nothing to this, the amount of complexity you can get into with this, and just how easy this is to run.
So you think it's simpler than the other things, the other systems? Like, I know there's been campaign systems that have come out throughout the years.
Well, this is more for people who actually want to have a little more depth to their campaign because they've always had the whole mid sort of style where, you know, you and your buddy play a battle and then you play this mission and then you go on to see who won, who lost. Then you play this mission, then you play like a final mission, or there's they had like rolling battlefield ones where you set up the table and then depending on who won, you basically shifted the terrain a bit and added more on to like show in advance. Or even like Planetary Empires where you're attacking tiles to get bonuses and so on and so forth like that. But nothing that is as easy as this and in depth as this.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, we've always played campaigns, but they've always been like, we've always done narrative campaigns. I find that a lot of times we try to organize a non-narrative campaign, like one with actual phases and everything like that. Instead of just saying it's okay, this happened, what would be cool next? Okay, let's move the story this way. But something with actual phases, actual rules, I find they break down a lot of the time.
Yeah, they're a lot more. They're very difficult to run. The more players you add in, the more difficult this can be. Not necessarily this system itself, but when like in our previous campaigns we've run, they've sort of fallen flat because people haven't been able to play their games you know.
So, okay, let's do a brief overview of what this thing is.
Sure, yeah. So this basic overview is that you and your team and yourself are playing against another team, traitors or loyalists, and you're fighting anywhere from small little skirmishes on a planet to system-wide assault. And you're basically spending your reserve points to make attacks, and your opponents are doing likewise, and you're trying to gain the most strategic objectives.
Yeah, you're trying to attack strategic objectives, which can be planets, which can be cities, however you want to design your narrative. Yeah, you gain control points from successful attacks, and at the end of it, when everybody's expended all their resources, all their reserve points, whoever has the most control points, whichever side has the most control points, wins. Just like that, it's fairly simple. It's incredibly simple. It's just you can bolt on so much complexity and so many layers that I think that's what makes this so special.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so let's get into it then. Today we're going to do the basic rules. So let's start with, there's two things that you need to do when you decide that you're running a Conquest campaign. Or three things. First of all, you're going to have to assemble your players. And you're going to have to divide it in two groups, traitors and loyalists, and try to make it as even as possible. There may very well be odd numbers, or one side could have more players than the other. It shouldn't be too much, because otherwise it's just not fun.
I mean, the easiest way to swing to, if you have weird teams, you say you have more traitors than loyalists and people are wanting to play Mechanicum, you could always throw a Mechanicum player on either side. You could always say you're playing a loyalist traitor legion, like some people who haven't heard about the heresy and, you know, well, they've heard about the heresy, but they decide to fight for the loyalist cause instead.
Yeah, like Kyr Valen. I mean, there's so many loyalist Iron Warriors players out there. So yeah, I think it's pretty easy to balance it out. So that's the goal. You're going to try to have sides that are even as possible between loyalists and traitors. And as you said, Mechanicum can be on either side. All right. Then you have, okay, to build your campaign system, there's two things you need to do. You need to construct your war zone, and then you need to decide on a reserve points pool. So let's start with war zone, with constructing a war zone. So how does a war zone work?
So a war zone is basically a collection of key features that represent your strategic objectives that you're going after. Like, you could do anywhere from a basic just spreadsheet and go, we're fighting on planet X, and there's, you know, this one, there's like three strategic objectives, and just keep track on a spreadsheet. Or you could even draw a map, or you could use a Planetary Empires kit. Like, the what you can do is awesome with this.
So pretty much you have to decide on what this is going to be. I think the most important thing for me there would be to decide, okay, like, what is the basic, what is it that we're fighting over? It could be a planet. It could be a city. You know, it'd be really cool having, because a war zone can be anything. It can be a sector, or it can be a part of a city. It can be anything, so long as you can decide on a number of strategic objectives that are going to be inside the city. We'll get to how many strategic objectives you need later, but okay. Essentially, you have to decide what you're doing. What I think would be really cool, for example, is imagine you're fighting over like a city. Like imagine like a Stalingrad kind of campaign. Your war zone is like Stalingrad, and then your strategic objectives are like, you know, the workers' housing sector, or the grain elevator sector, or the port sector. And these are your strategic objectives that you're fighting over. And you can have a really, really cool, fluffy campaign with that. And you don't have to start designing entire star systems full of stuff.
Exactly. You could even do this as a Zone Mortalis, and you're boarding an enemy ship.
Yeah, like, for example, like your war zone could be the ship. Like, the Contrador? What's that? The Iron Warrior ship that got boarded at Fal?
I think it's Contrador.
Yeah, okay. And you could have, okay, the bridge is one strategic objective, and the landing, the breach zone is another strategic objective. The engines are another strategic objective.
Weapons or something, you know? Yeah, like
weapons. You can do that, and that can be your war zone. And I think that's the most interesting parts about this system, that it doesn't force you, it doesn't pigeonhole you into fighting over a planet or something like that. You can make your war zone anything you want, so long as you can define actual strategic objectives. Like
you could even like be fighting for like a small town, even like if you wanted to play strategic raids, or you wanted to use Victory's Vengeance.
Absolutely, that'd be cool. We should think about that, about like integrating Victory's Vengeance and a conquest system, because I think it'd be really doable.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. All right, you know what? I'm writing that down for episode 3. I want to start thinking about how we can do that. That's a great idea. Okay, anyways, that's the first thing you're gonna do, is you're gonna have to design your war zone, decide what you're fighting over, and then you have to decide on how many reserve points you have. Mark, you want to run us down what reserve points are?
Reserve points are used basically to initiate attacks on your opponent, and you have a set number of reserve points, and once your reserve points are spent, you can no longer initiate any attacks. And they have a sort of a recommended list here of how many reserve points you should have depending on the amount of players in your campaign, and it goes anywhere from 3 reserve points to 5 for like a little isolated skirmish, all the way up to like 13 to 15 points for a system-wide, and then it has determines the amount of players you have. That's sort of what's going to determine how many points you have.
Yeah. And you have to remember that a reserve point, when you expend a reserve point to make an attack on a strategic objective, every strategic objective is going to be a game, which means that, and each side has an equal amount. So, for example, if you're playing with like a system-wide assault with 15 reserve points per side, that's 30 games you need to play. So you really need to think about how many games your group is actually going to be able to play, how often you play.
Like the system-wide assault might be something you want to plan with your buddies to play over, say, like half the year or the whole year.
Yeah, but that's always a challenge, eh? That's always a challenge to get people to play their games.
But also, too, the number of reserve points you have also dictates the number of recommended strategic objectives. It's just a recommendation, but they have a really good system laid out for it. So basically, they have 1 to 5 reserve points. They recommend 3 strategic objectives, 6 to 11, 5, 12 to 14, 7, and 15 plus 9.
And this, I think, is to keep things from getting a little too confused. I mean, you could easily play with, you know, 9 strategic objectives and 5 reserve points. I mean, nothing's stopping you from doing this. But then the problem is a lot of the strategic objectives won't be claimed because you don't have enough reserve points to do it. And it also gets a little bit confusing because for every attack that you make by expending a reserve point, the defending side has to choose one of its players to go defend that objective. So it can get a little confusing. So I think that their recommended, the basic recommended chart is pretty fair.
Yeah, definitely. And it's good to note too that when you're the attacker and you spend a point to attack a strategic objective to get the control point, even if the defender wins, they don't get the control point. So you have to attack to get points.
Exactly. And you don't score every turn just by sitting on an objective. You have to actually make attacks to gain control and gain control points. And at the end, whoever has the most control points is the victor. So you have to expend your reserve points to actually get games and get attacks in and try to push the enemy back. You can't just sit back and sit on objectives and hope to gain points. And I think this is another thing that makes this really interesting, in that it encourages aggressive play. And I think that's really cool. Okay, I think it's important before we go into talking about the turns, talking about how the campaign turns work, go real quick on what armies are supposed to be used. Which I think is another one of these fun parts, is that this isn't only Istvan 3 and 5. You're supposed to design your own thing. So they recommend, in Conquest, they recommend, of course, the Legion Crusade list, Legio Cybernetica, Ordo Reductor, Tegmata, Questoris, Knights Crusade list, and Solar Auxilia. Now, of course, this was published before Tempest, so, you know, Imperialist Militia and Warp Cults is good too, I'm sure.
No one should have a problem with that.
But yeah, it's designed to be used with fully 30k armies, so.
I guess it depends on your group too. You could even decide on set armies if you wanted.
But one thing is really important is that unique special characters should not be duplicated.
Yes, yeah. No double Abaddon.
That's pretty obvious. But if everybody's playing different legions, I mean, I don't think it's too much of a problem. But yeah, you have to make sure, just for pure fluff reasons, that the loyalist side doesn't have 5 Kyr Valens.
Exactly.
So I think that's actually a really important rule. Or even better, don't use any special characters at all. But that's just me.
Well, there are rules later on in this book for getting little bonuses to your characters too.
But absolutely, yes. There is character advancement. This is another really good reason to make your own special characters, make your own characters for this campaign, because there is character advancement rules. We will get into that. They're optional. We'll get into it the next episode. I think this episode we really need to break down how the basic system works. So are we good for the for creating war zones and what strategic objectives are?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's get into how the campaign turn works.
So each campaign turn is comprised of 3 phases: the mustering phase, the conflict phase, and the consolidation phase. And the mustering phase basically is your team is rolling off against their team to see who has the initiative. And the team that has the initiative basically declares their attack first, and then you go back and forth declaring your attacks.
Now, you don't have to... every attack that you declare, essentially, you're issuing challenges. So what you're saying is you expend a reserve point. When you have the initiative, when it's your turn to declare attacks, essentially, you're declaring a challenge. You're saying, okay, this player... Okay, you nominate one of your players, one of the players on your team. I don't know if I'm guessing you can have a team warlord if you want, like someone that runs it, but... more than likely, it's just going to be through mutual agreement. You nominate one of your players to declare a challenge against a strategic objective. Player X will be attacking strategic objective 1. Again, this is not about fluff today. And then the defending side chooses one of its players to defend in that scenario. And you continue doing this, taking turns to issue challenges and then choosing a defender to defend a strategic objective until either you don't want to do anymore... until you run out of players, because every player can do one challenge. So until you run out of players, or you run out of reserve points. So it's technically possible to only play a single campaign turn, I guess, if you have too many players.
Yeah, you could. Unlikely. One side could not attack, period, and the other side could launch a massive attack and use all of their resource points.
Yeah, but the thing is, the defender wouldn't get any points in that turn. So there's no reason to do that.
No, there isn't, but you could. Like, you have the option.
Now, I think there's a little contradiction in these rules that I don't think is a big problem, but in the mustering phase, it says that the challenge, that the mustering phase ends when you run out of players issuing challenges, but then it says that players can play as many games as they want.
Maybe they're just saying those are the only ones that you can score points on, but people can play more games if they want.
Yeah, maybe you're right about that. Either way, it recommends that that each player plays one game, and I think that's pretty smart. Having tried to run a lot of campaigns, I think that simplifies things quite a bit. And also, when someone challenges, like when a player challenges a strategic objective, you have to be smart about this, about organizing like who's going to defend the objective. You really have to organize things through people's schedules or people's availability and things like that, like when you're making the decision on who's going to be the defender. So try to pair off, pretty much where you're trying to pair people off, where they're likely to actually play their games. Because it happens too often in campaigns that people don't play their games. So try to work together. Both sides should be working together to make this run smoothly. I can't stress that enough. So, okay, once again, challenge phase. The team with the initiative issues a challenge. One of the players in the team with the objective issues a challenge. The defending team chooses a player to defend the challenge, and it keeps taking turns doing that until either you're out of reserve points or you decide not to issue any more challenges. Then, probably a good idea to write all this stuff down.
Yeah, they recommend that, actually, yeah. In the conflict phase.
That's the second phase. After like all the games, all the challenges have been issued, and all the players have been paired off, all the games have been scheduled and whatever, then it's the conflict phase. That's when you play your games. That's when you roll your dice.
Yeah, and you basically note down your results and everything like that. Like, say you're not all playing at the same location, like player Timmy's playing player Bob or something, but they can't play till next weekend, and they're playing at his place. They just note down the result, and then they bring it in when you do the consolidation phase.
Yeah, pretty much. That's the simplest thing. You play your games, and you write down your results. Now, of course, depending on if you're using special rules, if you're using all the optional stuff that we're going to discuss next time, this can add some complexity to what needs to be noted down. But as for the basic system, it's pretty much win or lose or draw. I guess it's possible to draw. So,
yeah, and that, in which case, nobody gets points.
Yeah. So that's pretty much it's pretty simple at the basic game. So it's everybody's play their games. Everybody that's playing in the campaign has played the games they're supposed to play, and you know who's won where. Then you do the consolidation phase.
And each game in which the attacker is victorious, they score one control point at the strategic objective for their side.
Once again, every win you get nets you a control point.
And basically you see if you've spent all your resource points at this point, the campaign is over. But if not, you go on and you start a fresh phase.
Which is more than likely going to happen. But once again, it is possible to expend all your reserve points. It's unlikely, but it's possible that you can expend all your reserve points in the first turn and only play a single phase. That wouldn't be all that fun, though.
It could be neat, though, representing a mass landing on a planet or something like that, and you're just committing everything all at once, and then the defender has to counterattack.
This is just so simple. It's so simple compared to a lot of... Because remember, once you've won your game at a strategic objective and you've gained your control point, nothing really, like, you don't have to like record who's controlling that objective at that point. He's not automatically the defender. You're not stuck there waiting to be attacked. Pretty much what ends up happening is now both sides, it's like, okay, you score your point, and then in the next turn you start it over.
You can attack the same objective multiple times to get more points if you want.
Absolutely. And
because that affects some of the optional rules. Who has the most points at this objective will affect some of the things that you can do.
This system is just so simple, but so you can add so much complexity to it. It's really, really well thought out. What we're just describing now is incredibly simple to run.
Yeah, and they do recommend if everybody's expend, like all your resource points have been expended and it's a dead draw, they recommend playing a giant game.
Yeah, you play Apocalypse at that point to decide who won. No one wants a draw. That's where there's shootouts in hockey now. No one likes draws. So, yeah, there's another thing. We mentioned that it might be a good idea to have a warlord, and we forgot that it's actually it's written right here. So, Mark, what's a campaign warlord?
The campaign warlord is basically to keep track of your side's point. He's like your he's your Gulliman.
Is your Gulliman the war accountant?
Yeah.
Fights wars with an abacus?
Yeah. Like, you could even add in a little bit more complexity here too, if you want. You could have people roll their warlord traits and keep their warlord traits for the whole campaign, right?
I think that would be really, really recommended. But you know what? Since we're talking about warlords, we should maybe go into strategic warlord traits. But before we do that, are we good with the campaign turn and with creating Warzone?
Yeah, that's we got it locked down.
It's amazing. It's so simple. So pretty much if you want to run a basic simple conquest system, like a conquest campaign, you could do this over a weekend if you wanted. Essentially, you create your war zone, what you're fighting over, you decide how many reserve points and how many strategic objectives, and you should name them, but again, we're just talking about basic stuff.
Exactly. You could go Google spreadsheet, or you could have some thought and love for the fluff.
Of course. Well, we're Horus Heresy players, so love of the fluff is pretty important. I can't imagine anybody playing this system and just having Warzone trait X and strategic objectives 1, 2, and 3. That doesn't seem very likely, but you can if you want. So yeah, you create your Warzone. You can do that in 5 seconds. I just created a Warzone right now, Warzone X, with strategic objectives 1, 2, and 3. And then you can start right away and do your first campaign turn. You roll initiative, you issue your challenges, you play your games, and then you figure out who scored where. That's the basic system. It's just gorgeous and its simplicity. So we were talking about adding a warlord. So each side, if you're playing with enough players, each side should have one warlord. I mean, this is an optional rule, but I think it's pretty important. One person gets. Their warlord gets a strategic warlord trait.
Yeah, this is your commander-in-chief, high lord, lord general, war master, whatever's appropriate, right?
Yeah, yeah. So pretty much you're going to roll at the beginning of the campaign, your warlord's going to roll d6 for his strategic warlord trait. Do we want to go through them?
Yeah, we probably should.
Really, really cool. Okay, if you roll a 1, it's master of contingencies. It's used in the mustering phase. After determining which side is to be the attacker and which is the defender, the commander-in-chief's controlling player may decide to reverse these roles by rolling a d6 in any single game a member of their side is playing in. On a roll 4+, the roles are swapped.
So all of a sudden, your attacker is your defender, and their defender is the attacker.
I can see that being pretty useful, actually, because remember, only the attackers are scoring points.
Because who knows, maybe they put up a really good player to be their defender, but he doesn't have a very good list for attacking.
Well, not only that, but remember, you can score an extra point there. Because remember, all of your attacks are possibilities of scoring a point. And in this one, on a D6, one of those is reversed. The attacking player, the attacking side, now instead of getting the opportunity to get a control point, all he can do is stop you from getting an extra one. That's really cool. That's really powerful. Do you understand what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's a wicked.
So it gives you an extra opportunity to get a control point.
Mm-hmm.
So if you roll 2, it's Logistician Prime. This strategic warlord trait is used in the consolidation phase. In one single game in which a loss has been suffered, if the other side gains a control point, roll a d6. On a roll of 4+, the commander-in-chief side gains a control point 2.
Oh, that's nice. I like that one.
3, Master of Timing. Whenever a roll is made on a table to determine which of a set of missions is to be played, the commander-in-chief's controlling player may insist that the dice is re-rolled. The second result indicates the mission that must be played. For example, if the players have agreed to play one of the battles in the Age of Darkness city fight missions presented in this book, the Master of Timing may force a reroll on the mission selection chart.
So if you've encountered a mission that your army isn't particularly good at, you can reroll it, right?
Yep. Again, really cool.
So what do we got next? We got Marshal of the Host. This strategic warlord trait is used in the mustering phase. Having spent their reserve points, the controlling player rolls a d6. On a roll of 5+, the reserve point is regained.
That is epic.
Yep.
That is really, really good.
Then roll of 5, you got Master of the Field. When defending, the player may choose any one Warzone trait to apply to the upcoming mission. If both sides have strategic warlord traits, roll off to determine who has the upper hand. That's pretty neat, actually.
Yep. And we'll get to Warzone traits after we discuss this.
Perfect.
Just and so then it flows better, because we were talking about War Masters. Just so it flows better, we're going straight into this, but we'll talk about Warzone traits after.
Perfect. Then we've got Spy Master. This strategic warlord trait is used in the mustering phase. The warlord's controlling player may identify a single strategic objective on a roll and roll a d6. On a roll 4+, strategic objective may not be targeted in this conflict phase. That will come incredibly handy when you start adding in all the optionals.
Yep. I think 5 and 6 are, of course, are only useful when you're using Warzone traits. But why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? I know it's optional, but like, why wouldn't you use these? Do you see any of these being bad?
Considering what you're doing here, no, these are all incredibly fluffy and amazing for the game. They add a lot of interesting complexity to it.
Yeah, what do you think the best one is? Like, if you got to choose, which one would you choose?
If I got to choose, Logisticien Prime.
Yeah, I know, that's pretty powerful.
But once again, they're all really good. I just like the idea that, well, I get to gain a point too when you gain a point on a 4+.
No, it's really, really cool. Also, the character that has the strategic warlord trait, there are rules that we'll discuss in the next episode for characters dying, like if they get killed, and then you have to choose a new commander-in-chief, and then you make a new role.
Yeah.
So, just something to note. Now, if you are using Primarchs, and there's a good chance you're going to be using Primarchs in this, Primarchs already have, most of them have strategic warlord traits that are already that are already locked in. Now, if you're using a bunch of Primarchs, only one of them is the Commander-in-Chief. If every player is using one of the Primarchs, only one of them is the War Master, and it should be the War Master.
Yeah, especially if the War Master is there.
Exactly. I think that should be a rule. It's not in here, but that should be a rule. If the traitor's side, if someone's using Horus, if there's a Horus on the field, Horus is automatically the leader. Well, you know what? I take that back. And here's why. Say that you're playing a scenario where you're storming a fortress or something like that. Maybe Perturabo should be your warlord. Horus isn't an idiot. He'll follow his brother's advice if necessary. Okay, let's go through the Primarchs and we'll see and talk about what they have, and I think it's really cool. So if you're playing as your boy the Lion, he gets master timing automatically and he gets one random roll. And if you get a double, you reroll, of course. No point in having master of timing twice.
No, definitely not.
Okay, Fulgrim has two random. Perturabo has Logistician Prime and one random, which is awesome. Very appropriate. Jagatai Khan has a Master of the Field and one random. Lehman Russ, Master of Timing and one random. Rogel Dorm has Logistician Prime and Spy Master. I guess using the Agents of the Sigilite, I would assume.
Yeah.
Conrad Kurz has Master of Timing and Master of Contingencies. Sanguinius has Master of the Field and one random. Ferris Manus has two random. Now, here's a really interesting one. Angron has none, which I guess is appropriate. He has no strategic warlord traits, but on a roll of 4+, the enemy commander-in-chief may not use theirs.
Yeah, that's all.
So he pretty much, on a 4+, you deny your opponent the use of his strategic warlord traits. I guess Angron probably shouldn't. I don't know. I think he should have had something. I feel like he could have had Master of Timing or something like that.
For who?
Or Master of the Field.
For Angron?
No, yeah, Angron. I don't know. He's not an idiot.
He's not an idiot, but when the butcher nails kick in and he goes into battle, everything goes out the window.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. Including your opponent's strategic warlord traits.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, Angron has none. That's okay. He probably shouldn't be your warlord anyway. If you get to choose, I mean, it probably shouldn't be.
This is pretty damn good, though.
May not use theirs, that campaign turn. So the enemy commander-in-chief can't use any of them.
Yeah.
It's not just one, eh?
Yeah, it's all of them.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. That's pretty good. That's pretty good ability. Well, let's get going. Good old Gulliman. Bob Gulliman has three, and he can choose them.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. I mean, he can choose three of them, and he doesn't roll. So that's pretty big.
Yeah.
Mortarion has two random. Magnus the Red, Master of Contingencies and Spymaster. And Spymaster, in this case, probably represents his ability to see the future. The Warmaster Horus has Spymaster and two random. So him and Bob are the only ones with three.
Yeah.
Lorgar has two random. Vulcan has two random. Korax has Master of Timing and Master of the Field. And Alpharius has all six.
And you can only use each one once per campaign.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is pretty neat. This adds extra layer of strategy to the campaign, to be honest.
Well, then each may only be used once per campaign. So you get to choose one, and that's the one you're using?
No, you can use each one once. So the first campaign round, you're going to go, I'm going to use Spymaster. Second campaign round, I'm going to use Master of the Field or something, right?
Yeah, that's pretty powerful.
But can you see the layout strategy added into this? Like, say the Imperials, their Master-in-Chief is going to be Gulliman, and say you've got, Fulgrim, Perturabo, and Angron on your side. Who are you going to want to pick?
To try to neutralize Gulliman?
Yeah, for example, you want Angron.
Yeah, on a 4+, you're neutralizing his strategic warlord traits, yeah?
Yeah, so like it's neat. It has its neat level of like strategy to it. I love it.
Can you use all of them in one turn, in a campaign turn?
Nothing is stopping you from using all of them.
So what would you say is the strongest one of these?
Well, Gulliman probably, yeah.
Yeah, I would think. Three chosen, that's pretty huge. I would like Horus to have maybe Spymaster and two chosen or something like that.
Yeah, mind you, though, in an extended campaign, like a longer one, Alpharius might be the best.
Yeah, but you can only use one once per campaign, so if you're playing more than six phases, which seems unlikely, but if you're playing more than six phases, I mean, you're going to run out of points.
Yeah. You know,
run out of I guess, strategic traits. But yeah, Alpharius is really strong. I would say Alpharius and Gulliman are the two strongest.
And Angron. I got to throw Angron up there.
Yeah, but you got to roll. If it was automatic, yeah, but you got to roll a 4+.
It's still, it's just awesome. Random chaos because Angron is around.
Yeah. It's just all of Gulliman's best laid plans come to nothing because Angron's on the field.
Yep.
Actually, I think that's really, really cool. So yeah, I know these are optional, but we're sticking them into this first episode where we're talking about the basic rules because I don't see why you wouldn't use these rules. They're just really, really cool. And also because it's all in the same part of the book, so we might as well do our discussion like that. So, okay, once you've chosen on your side, you've chosen a warlord, you've rolled up your strategic warlord trait, or if you're a Primarch, you might get them automatically. So you have to choose your one warlord out of all your players. One side gets to be one character gets to be commander-in-chief. And the other thing that's I think pretty essential is to actually start thinking about giving your Warzone some warlord traits. Doing some Warzone traits. All right, I think these are really, really cool. The strategic warlord traits are awesome. There's two of them though that we mentioned were kind of contingent on using warzone traits. So Master of the Field and Spymaster. These are kind of contingent on further developing the basic campaign.
Yes. So
maybe we could talk real quick. We're going to go into this in greater depth in 2 weeks when we talk about all the optional rules. But just to clear up like why these two strategic warlord traits are useful, maybe we can just talk about what Warzone traits are and strategic objectives traits. And then we can go into them more detail next time.
Okay.
So what's a Warzone trait?
A Warzone trait is a trait that's applied to a single strategic objective.
No, the entire Warzone. Oh, or either way. It can be applied to a single strategic objective or it can be applied to the entire Warzone.
Yes, yeah.
So I'll give you an example. If remember the example I gave earlier of playing like something like a Stalingrad kind of Warzone? Like your Warzone's a broken city. Then you could, for example, you could give the entire Warzone the Hive Cities special rule, or the Broken Runescape special rule. So the whole Warzone is using, like, okay, let's use Broken Runescape as an example. If you chose to give the entire Warzone this Warzone trait, it means that at least half of the terrain pieces deployed, whenever you play a game, at least half of the terrain pieces must be Treacherous Ruins. And Treacherous Ruins are a terrain piece of this kind counts as a ruin and is considered to be difficult terrain. Models in Treacherous Ruin receive 4+ cover save, regardless of whether or not they are 25% obscured. In addition, whenever a unit moves within a treacherous ruin and rolls a double on their difficult terrain test, they encounter a relic of the war that devastated the area, for example. And then you get a roll on the treacherous ruins table. So it adds a little bit of extra flavor to your games. Okay, so in my example, we're giving the entire war zone, the entire broken city, the broken runescape special rule. And then you can give each individual strategic objective a special rule. So for example, okay, let's see, one part of the city is pretty much where like the workers housing sector, right? Then you can give that strategic war zone the Hive Cities special rule. That strategic objective, you can give that strategic objective the Hive Cities war zone trait, which means in a game in that strategic objective, at least half of the terrain pieces deployed must be Hive Hab blocks, and Hive Hab blocks have more special rules. Which I guess we not really worth for our purposes going through them. Once again, we'll go into these Warzone traits with more detail next time. But so what would happen is that strategic objective would have both the RuneScape rule because it's within the Warzone and would also have the Hive Cities Warzone trait. But another strategic objective might be, I don't know, Rad Wastes, for example, like which would represent a part of the city that was destroyed by Rad missiles or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. You could even, like, say the example we use where you're boarding a spaceship, you could use some right out of Zomar Talus and say that the whole ship is open to the void.
Something like that, yeah. But then specific areas would have different special rules. So that's what we mean by the Warzone traits can be used by both for the entire Warzone and for strategic objectives. And this will make things a lot more interesting. And this is where something like a strategic warlord trait, Master of the Field, which allows you to choose any one Warzone trait to apply in the upcoming mission. So essentially, this would represent your warlord essentially deciding essentially where the battle is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like where specifically within the sector.
Yeah, I mean, there's some that wouldn't necessarily mesh too well together, but
yeah, but you have to play it. You know, you have to play it fluffy. For example, I'll give you an example because I mentioned Rad Waste, right?
Yeah.
So say that you're using a strategic warlord with the Master of the Field trait. Your commander in chief has Master of the Field, and you get to choose a Warzone trait. Just like looking at it narratively, you could say, okay, you decide that we're going to be playing with the Rad Wastes, the special rule for this game, because like my commander in chief is unleashing rad missiles on this city.
Yeah.
You know, you have to look at it like that. Or Seas of Fog. Seas of Fog's another example. This can represent like a massive smoke barrage, for example. You have to do these things you have to choose these things narratively.
Oh, definitely. Like you have a mission where your night lords are attacking and you want it to be night fighting the whole game. So you pick Unending Night and like say a battle cruiser or something has come down from orbit and is like right over the city.
Yeah, the problem is Conrad Kurz does not have Master of the Field.
No, he could get it though, couldn't he?
No, his is locked in Master of Timing and Master of Contingencies.
But he might not be your warlord, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, this is where this strategic trait becomes really, really cool. There's this other one that's important as Spymaster, and this comes into strategic objective traits. So we'll talk about strategic objective traits real quick. What are strategic objective traits?
Those are traits that are applied to the strategic objective.
Yes, but they are a little more complex than just Warzone traits. Warzone traits you'll have night fighting for the entire turn, but strategic objective traits are a little more complex.
Yeah. Sorry, I totally misheard what you said there. Yeah, like you have a planetary starport, armory vaults, macro weapon battery, stuff like that.
Yeah, the macro weapon battery is awesome. Mark, you want to describe that one, does?
Basically, in the mustering phase, if you can have more control points at the macro cannon than your opponent, you roll a d6 on a roll of 5+. The enemy reduces its reserve points pool by -1.
Whoever has the most control points at a strategic objective gets to fire the macro weapons battery, right?
Yes.
And yeah, roll 5+, but anyways. And this is when it gets really, really, really... It adds complexity, it adds strategy to it, right? Because if each one of the strategic objectives has one of these traits and everything, then you can start deciding, okay, we need to take control of this macro weapons battery. We need to get some control points onto this so we can fire the macro weapons. And what makes Spymaster really cool and what's really fun about this, it adds an extra level of strategy because the way that you fire the macro weapons, for example, we're just using this as an example once again, the way you do that is whoever has the most control points at that strategic objective at the beginning of the mustering phase gets to fire it. So say that you have 5 control points on the macro cannon battery, the macro weapon battery strategic objective, and your opponent has 4. Now you want to maintain control of it, and you want to make sure that that your opponent doesn't take it. So you can use Spymaster, and on a 4+, your opponent can't target it. No one can target that. So you maintain control of it in the next mustering phase, and you can keep trying to reduce your opponent's reserve points pool.
Definitely. It's amazing.
That's awesome. And it adds so many layers of strategy to this. You can start thinking, okay, we need to put everything we have into trying to take this spaceport, for example.
Yeah.
And this is how you start bolting on extra levels of complexity and narrative to your campaign. Now, once again, I'll repeat, we're not gonna go into this in too much depth because that's the purpose of our next episode where we're gonna really talk about all the optional rules. I think that just explaining how strategic warlord traits and Warzone and strategic objective traits work, I think that helps explain how the basic system functions. And once again, we'll go into more detail about all these optional rules in the next episode. But maybe just a quick summary of the basic system, though. All you need to run this campaign, like we've been talking about, like you know, Primarchs and a bunch of extra levels, but all you really need to run this campaign is a couple players. You need to like set up into two teams. A couple players set up into two teams, traitors and loyalists. You need to create a war zone, which can be as simple as Warzone X with a couple strategic objectives in it. And then you roll some dice. That's how subtle and beautifully simple this campaign system is. Now, of course, you know, we couldn't help but talk about some of the optional rules and because they're so cool. And that's going to be the goal of the next episode. We're going to talk about all the optional rules that you can throw into this. Once again, we're trying to encourage people to actually try this system. It is so cool. It is so much fun that I'm hoping we can help break it down a little bit and just to show how simple it is to get done and just how much strategy goes into something so simple. I think it's brilliant.
Oh, heck yeah. I can't wait to try this out.
You also talked about how you can maybe we can end with this. You want to talk about how to integrate planetary empires?
Yeah, you could just do a little graph or whatever for your campaign or draw a little map out. But what you could do is you could use your planetary empires tiles, make your little world or continent or whatever you're trying to represent, and then use little markers to place on them to represent the strategic objectives.
Yeah, that's a pretty good idea too.
And that gives you more of a feel of battles going on this planet or this moon or whatever you're doing.
And I'm sure so many people out there are like us and have a board made up of planetary empires that just sits there.
Like my giant one?
Yeah. That never gets played. That's another reason this thing is just so cool. But yeah, that's a good visual way to do it. Or if someone's really good at drawing too, you can draw like a really nice map or anything like that. But what we're trying to say today is that if you don't want to do all that stuff, you can still play a campaign and just, you know, Warzone X. This stuff is brilliant. Do you think that's good for just the basic system and some of the basic simple options?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so that'll do it for today. We will be back in 2 weeks to discuss optional rules. And right now, we are going to go right into a book club where we will be discussing Mark's favorite book, Vulcan Lives.
Vulcan Lives.
I lived. Despite the fire I had against the odds, survived. I remember the furnace, or at least fragments of what it had done to me. I remembered my skin blistering, the stench of burning fat, the smoke from cooking meat filling my eyes as the vitreous humor boiled within them. Scorched black, rendered to ash, I was nothing but dust. A shadow without form, not unlike my Gowler brother's favorite aspect. And yet, I lived. The furnace was gone. Ferris was gone. All was darkness and cold. I remember that I was on a ship somewhere in deep space. I remembered the prison that my iron-hearted sibling had made for me, a cage strong enough to hold a Primarch. I was still weak. My limbs felt heavy and my hearts were beating furiously in my chest as some act of enhanced physiology worked to keep me alive. Perhaps I had healed, some regenerative gift I didn't know I possessed. More likely the furnace was not real, nor my ordeal in it. I had been seeing the grim corpse visage of my dead brother after all. Who knew what traumas my mind had endured? For a moment I considered the possibility that all this was fabrication. That I was lying on Istvan 5, wounded, in a Suzanne membrane coma. Or that I had been recovered and my body labored to revive itself in some clinical apothecarian chamber, my mind struggling to catch up with it. All of this I dismissed. My abduction was real. Kurz was real. This place, this prison that Perturabo had made for me, was real. There was no waking up from a nightmare. This was the nightmare. I was living it. Every tortured breath. But it was hard to think, to reason. Ferris's very presence and everything I had seen or not seen made me question myself. It was harrowing enough to have flesh and bone rent, split, and cleaved, but what was truly terrifying was the slow erosion of sensibility, of self, and the trust in my capacity to tell reality from fantasy. How can you defend yourself against your own mind? What your senses tell you? There was no armor for that, no shield or protection, save strength of will and the ability to reason. I didn't try to rise. I didn't voice my defiance or anger. I merely breathed and let the coolness of my darkling cell wash over me. I tried to recall everything I knew of my Gowler, everything I could accurately remember. And then, closing my eyes, I allowed myself to dream. All right, we are back for book club, and today we were doing Vulcan Lives. Now, the main reason that we're doing Vulcan Lives is we're slowly moving into to our second episode on Unremembered Empire to deal with all the feedback we've gotten. But since Vulcan Lives really is a great lead into Unremembered Empire, I thought it would be cool to do something in the proper order for a change.
Let's do it.
So, Mark, what is the synopsis for Vulcan Lives? What's your synopsis?
This is the story of what happens to Vulcan after the drop site massacre. It follows a ragtag band of Raven Guard, Salamanders, and Iron Hands, basically waging a guerrilla war against the Word Bearers.
Pretty much. Vulcan winds up getting captured by captured by the traitors and gets stuck into a torture dungeon, Conrad Kurz's torture dungeon. Yeah, pretty much Kurz breaks his mind.
Yeah, and it's that's when the man Perturabo made him that, didn't he?
Yep, Perturabo made him. And at the same time as Vulcan's getting tortured on, I guess, the Nightfall. Is he on the Nightfall?
He must be. This must be going on while the Thramas Crusade is going on as
no,
well.
No, it's before Thramas.
It is?
You know what? Let's talk about that real quick, about timeline, because timeline is one of those things that, not really confusing, but it is a little bit odd. Maybe not. It's that this is before Thramas. This is between, while Vulcan Lives takes place, this whole book, it's between Istvan V and the Night Lords arriving at Thramas. Because
he escapes at the end, and he arrives on Ultramar when the Dark Angels show
3 years later. Yeah, he arrives on Ultramar 3 years later. Because he mentions that he's on his way. When he's mentioned, it's like, when Kurz is begging Vulcan to kill him, he mentions that, I'm gonna do it again. I'm gonna kill one of my brothers. Maybe I'll kill the lion when I get to Thramas. So this is before Thramas. So essentially, Vulcan disappears at the end of this, and shows back up 3 years later, 3 years later. The question is, where is he for those years?
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that. Because he does mention about the Thramas Crusade, but who knows how long he's been torturing him.
No, but it's clear that this is before Thramas.
Well, they don't mention that at the end of the book, though.
Absolutely they do. They mention it while, at that final battle, right before Vulcan says, I could have left at any time.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He mentions he's on his way to Thramas. So this is before the Thramas Crusade. All of
okay.
this
All
is
right.
between
I forgot that, yeah.
in the couple months between Istvan V and the beginning of the Thramas Crusade.
Okay. All right.
So
gotcha.
Vulcan disappears for 3 years, or 2.5, 3 years. I think it's almost 3 years, the Thramas Crusade, right?
Yes.
And then when the Pharaoh structure illuminates Macragge, that's when he reappears and, you know, goes through the atmosphere. So where was he?
I have no idea.
Was he just traveling? Was he in the warp? Was he stuck in the warp? I mean, that's a simple explanation for everything, eh?
Well, yeah, he was teleporting, so they did go through the warp.
Yeah. I don't know. This isn't a criticism I have on the book. It's just I don't know the answer to the question. Like, where was he for 2.5, 3 years? It's bizarre. But I guess that might help explain. Because, yeah, I figure he was in the warp. I figure he's just lost in the warp. Because everybody's lost in the warp, during the rune storm, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's what it was. He was just lost in the warp in a dimension where time has no meaning. And then the Pharaoh structure illuminating Macragge and everything like that. And since the Pharaoh structure has sort of there's emotive reasons to it, you know, it's empathic. It functions
yeah.
through empathy. So maybe it dragged him into Macragge.
That could make sense. Because, I mean, in 40K, there's stories of, you know, whole fleets disappearing and then showing up hundreds of years later. So.
Yeah. So, no, I don't think this is a problem with the book. I mentioned it just because I was a little bit confused to what happened, but I think that's the answer. That's what they were going for. In that Vulcan, he was just pretty much lost. And like everyone, he found Macragge. It's just he did it subconsciously. And I think that's actually how the Pharaoh structure kind of works.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I don't have a problem with that. And this helps explain a criticism I had on Unremembered Empire. Because remember I discussed when did Vulcan go insane? Because to the very end of Vulcan Lives, he's completely fine. Well, not completely fine. He's been tortured, but he feels that his mind's starting to go. That Kurz is breaking his mind. But he's pretty lucid at the end of Vulcan Lives.
Yeah, he's very defiant at the end too. He's ready to go.
Yeah, he's defiant, he's lucid, he's still Vulcan at the end of Vulcan Lives. However, when we see him again in Unremembered Empire, he's completely lost his mind. He's a savage.
So do you think that could be the warp playing with his mind since he's been in there for so long?
I don't think Kurz is the one that broke him. I think the warp broke him. I think he was trapped in the warp for 2.5, 3 years. And that'll probably screw with your mind. And this could be interesting because I'd like to know what happened in those 3 years. Maybe something really cool happened between the end of Vulcan Lives and the beginning of Unremembered Empire. Maybe he went through he went through some stuff. Hell, maybe that's in Deathfire. I haven't read it yet.
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe the answer is there. If you know the answer and if it's in Deathfire, don't let me know. I'm going to read it soon. I wait for the paperbacks to come out. Before I read these. But you know what? We ruined books for other people. Maybe someone will take their revenge on me. I got this book ruined for me. Vulcan Lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I asked, I was so pumped for reading Unremembered Empire, I remember. And I was talking to one of our buddies, and it's like, dude, can I skip Vulcan Lives? I figured this was about Istvan V, and I really wanted to read what was going on with Imperium Secundus, because I thought it was going to be really cool. I was wrong, but anyways. And so I asked my buddies, if I skip Vulcan Lives, I don't miss anything. And this is what he told me. All you need to know is that Vulcan dies at the end. That's that. Thanks, buddy.
You fucking asshole.
But anyways, we ruin books. We're book ruiners, so I can't get particularly mad at that one. We assume you've read these. Because why the hell else would you listen to it, unless you really don't care? But anyways, but yeah, this I don't know. I'd like to know what happened with Vulcan 3 years in the warp. Maybe there's something really cool that happened. Maybe he went. I don't know, maybe he encountered some stuff. Maybe he had a big adventure. Who the hell knows? There's 3 years missing. And that's one of the things I didn't get when I read this the first time. I should note that I'm really glad I reread this one.
Yeah.
Because I read it the first time on a 14-hour train and bus ride to Lansing, Michigan last year when I was presenting a paper at Michigan State. I think just I was getting kind of loopy towards the end. And I don't. I think it affected my my appreciation of the book, because you know when when you're on hour 13 of your trip, it could be a fun trip, but nothing can quite be enjoyable then. So I'm glad we managed to reread this. So that's the first thing I wanted to mention was question of timeline, but it's not a problem. It doesn't. I don't. It's not a criticism I have.
No, it's no big deal.
So, okay, we talked about the timeline. What's the role of this book? What's the point of it?
Well, you needed the, well, like I always say, you needed the Vulcan book because we haven't had one, right?
I think it's more than that. This is, you have to look at Vulcan Lives and Unremembered Empire together. Having reread it, I realized that looking at them separately is problematic because this is the same story. Vulcan Lives is the first part of the bridge book that is Unremembered Empire.
Sort of it tying is, them all together?
Yeah, exactly. It's the first effort to start tying things together. You're explaining where Kurz is going. You're explaining where... It's sort of like setting the stage for the second book. I mean, you got to explain Narek and everything like that. It really... It's not a complete book. It is the first of a two-parter. And when you read it as a complete book, when you read it separately, I don't think it works. But once you read it and you understand it as the first part of a two-part story, I think it works really well. So this is sort of setting the stage for what Unremembered Empire is. And what Unremembered Empire is, as we mentioned the last time, is sort of the book that ties storylines together. So you have all these disparate pieces that don't seem to fit together very well. But if you read it remembering what's in Unremembered Empire... It actually works together pretty well, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think, yeah, it's not only about giving Vulcan some screen time. It's also about setting up certain things, like setting up the Fulgurite spear and setting up what Erebus is doing and giving some more details on the Cabal. But you get no payoff in this book. There's no payoff. You get the payoff in Unremembered Empire.
Vulcan did need some screen time, too.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I agree. Absolutely. And you know what? He got some of the most interesting green time, I guess, of any of the Primarchs. Maybe we can move on to structure, because all of Vulcan's scenes are written in the first person. That's really weird. That doesn't happen very often. Can you think of another example of the first person in the series? Anyways, if anybody out there, I think there might be a short story that's written in the first person. I'm not entirely sure. There is a short story written in the second person. The story Athame from Mark of Kalth is written in the second person, which I find really interesting. I don't think there are, no. Someone out there, if there's other examples, I think there's a short story somewhere in the series that is written in the first person. But anyways, doesn't really matter. If someone out there remembers, let me know. So what role do you think is using the first person? Like, what does that add to Vulcan's scenes? I think it's really, really interesting.
Do you think it sort of adds how close he is to humanity?
It could be that's interesting, because he's the most human of the Primarchs, probably. And I mean, if you have Kurz in the first person and he's pretty much running through, it'd be like he'd just be running through like his insanity, you know? He would be a really unreliable a narrator. But Vulcan, I mean, since he's close to humanity, his mind is maybe the most understandable or relatable to a human, to a person like us.
Yeah, so maybe he has a lot of compassion for regular humans, where a lot of the Primarchs don't.
I think, yeah, that could be one of the major reasons. One of the other reasons to do this is because it's a really psychological story. It's showing how a person is being broken down mentally. And I think the first person is great for that, because a lot of this is psychological. A lot of what happens to Vulcan is psychological. So I think that's it's an interesting way to tell the story. And I think it works for this particular case. It works really, really well. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced the first person voice would actually work for most of the Primarchs, but for Vulcan, it seems to work. He's a really relatable character.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of flashbacks in this too, from Vulcan's flashbacks and Numian's flashbacks as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This book jumps around, and it's a fairly complex, it's actually a very complex book when you really get down to it. I mean, you have an A story and a B story, which don't feel that directly related. Mm-hmm. And then you have tons of flashbacks. And the Horus Heresy series does use flashbacks quite a bit. But these ones just jump all over the place. You flash back to the Great Crusade, to an incident on a planet.
Yeah, with the Night Lords and the Salamanders.
So you flash back to that. You flash back to Istvan 5. You get a lot of like flashback characters too that show up, like Vulcan's dad and Ferris, and there's a lot of complexity to how this story is organized. And my first read through, I didn't really appreciate it. I thought that the whole thing with the A and the B story, the A story is Vulcan on board the Nightfall getting tortured by Conrad Kurz.
Yeah.
The B story is, well, you want to run us through the B story real quick, what the B story is?
Well, that's the survivors, Numian and the various Iron Hands and Raven Guard, basically struggling with figure out if their Primarchs are alive. What are they supposed to do at this point, because they're so under strength?
Yes, the Shattered Legions. And in particular, the Shattered Legions right now are attacking. They see there's some word bearers on this planet, like doing some word bearer stuff.
Yep.
So they go to disrupt the traitors. That's all they do. The Shattered Legions are disrupting the traitors. The B story pretty much is about, you know, your old buddy John Grammaticus. Being John Grammaticus and doing John Grammaticus-y things. Word bearers are doing word bearers stuff. Grammaticus is doing Grammaticus stuff. Essentially, Grammaticus is on a mission from the Cabal to recover a spear. It's called the Fulgurite, or the Lightning Spear. And this spear, you find out in Unremembered Empire what the goal of the spear is, because it's not clear in this book what Grammaticus is. And this is why I mean this book doesn't work on its own. It's one of the few that really doesn't work on its own. Because once you read Unremembered Empire, you get all the details. You start to understand, okay, Fulgurite Spear can kill a Primarch, and John Grammaticus' mission is to kill Vulcan.
Yeah.
Because the Cabal, they want Vulcan off the table so the traitors would win. Because if Vulcan is healthy and alive, then Vulcan can be could potentially change the war, because that's an extra Primarch. That's the goal of the B story, is to set up this bit. It's all set up. There's no payoff for the B story. The B story is all set up what happens in Unremembered Empire. Grammaticus is pretty much his break with the Cabal, because you have Eldrad here. Maybe we should, let's talk about the B story. I think this is before we get into some more fun Conrad Kurz stuff.
Okay.
I think we should really take the time to break down exactly what Grammaticus's plan is and what's going on with the Cabal and everything like that. So if you recall in Legion, the Cabal is just a bunch of different alien races which are trying to defeat Chaos. And they come up with this theory that to defeat Chaos, Chaos must win the Horus Heresy. Because if pretty much they see what the Imperium becomes when the Emperor is crippled and stuck on the Golden Throne. And all it is just centuries of stagnation. And this is Chaos Ascendant. They see the Imperium winning as pretty much an imperial victory with the Emperor crippled will eventually lead to the ruinous powers winning. And the only way to defeat Chaos is by having Chaos win, having Horus win the war, and then through his own guilt and rage, again, essentially it would be all the traitor legions would fall upon each other, all humanity would fall upon itself if Horus were to win, and essentially humanity would go extinct. And with humanity going extinct, since the Eldar and most of the surviving alien races, like the Cabal races, since they're all hidden from Chaos, Chaos wouldn't be able to draw its emotional power from anything, because you can't draw it from orcs, and even if the Tyranids show up, you can't draw it from them. The Necrons are sleeping. The Tau are immune to chaos. Pretty much, and, you know, the Tau don't exist right now anyway. And pretty much there would be no... Chaos would be incredibly weak. Probably not destroyed, but incredibly weak if humanity were to go extinct, because humanity is right now where they're drawing most of their energy, their emotive energy, after the fall of the Eldar.
Yeah, they'd slowly fizzle out.
Yeah, exactly. They want chaos to fizzle out. There's going to be a... like maybe 100, 200 years of brutal civil war in humanity till humanity drives itself extinct, and then chaos powers will pretty much fizzle out and won't be a factor. So essentially, for the galaxy to survive and for chaos to be defeated, the Cabal believes that humanity needs to go extinct and Horus needs to win the war. That's what's usually called the Alpharius Gambit, because they use that to convince the Alpha Legion to join Horus's cause. Now the Cabal is working to try to ensure that the ruinous powers win, and in this book we're introduced to another part of their plan, which is to remove Vulcan, from the board. And to do this, because the problem is Vulcan can't die, that's the main thing you learn, is Vulcan is a perpetual. He has the Emperor's perpetuality, if you will.
Okay.
And so you need something special to kill him, and in this and what the Cabal discovers is that this lightning spear, the Fulgurite, can kill Vulcan. And that's the goal of the B story, is trying to gain control of this spear, and everybody's kind of fighting over it. And of course, Grammaticus isn't exactly forthcoming with the goal of the spear. It's clear
of
that
of course
he,
not.
No, he's not for. So he kind of tricks the he tricks the salamanders into helping him because he says that the spear can help their Primarch, but
help their Primarch die.
Yeah, but maybe when you see him in Unremembered Empire, that was probably a mercy kill.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe he wasn't lying after all. But yeah, the goal is to get this Fulgurite spear, and you know who helps him get it.
What's his name? Zardak? Or Narek, sorry.
No, well, Narek helps, yes, but Narek wants a spear for himself.
Eldred.
Well, Eldred doesn't want that at all. No, who helps Grammaticus get the spear is Erebus.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Erebus, that's why Erebus throughout the whole book keeps saying, it's like, don't kill the human, don't kill the human. It's because the human... Well, his mission is to kill Vulcan. It's interesting, Erebus. I wonder if Erebus knows what's going on with the Cabal.
Maybe, yeah.
Because it's really interesting. Because right now, because he seems to know that Grammaticus is his mission is to kill Vulcan, and he's down with that. What details does Erebus have? Like, does he know that the Cabal exists? Or maybe, and this is the other thought I had, maybe the Cabal is just a chaos ploy.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Well, they're helping them win. They managed to convince Alpharius to join the war.
Yeah.
On the traitor's side. So maybe, I'm just saying, maybe the Cabal will find out sometime down the line that they're a chaos cult or something like that, and they're just tricking people.
That is possible, yeah.
I have no idea, but yeah, I find it interesting that Erebus is the one that saves your favorite character, John Grammaticus. Oh. You must have loved that scene, eh? Two characters that you hate.
Yeah.
Really? Why do you hate John Grammaticus so much?
I just don't like the character. Nothing attractive about his character. I'm just like, he's a dick. He's as bad as Erebus in my mind.
He's as bad as Erebus, you think?
Yeah, he's basically a big tool, just like Erebus.
Okay. I don't hate John Grammaticus. He's not my favorite character because I think he's too... he's kind of... He enters Mary Sue category. I mean, he's just... But no, maybe not. He gets screwed over quite a bit, but... It's one of those characters that I think he's too wisecracking and too... What does he do that's so dickish for you?
Well, in this book particularly, it's the fact that he kills Nubian.
Yeah, it's kind of a shitty thing to do.
Because he was an awesome character, and I thought there was going to be more, and then, no, I shoot him with my laser ring, and he's dead. Just like, seriously? Come on.
But you hated him before. You can't because of that.
I didn't like him in Legion, either.
I thought he was cool in Legion. I don't know. I think he's an interesting character. I like all the Perpetuals, and I love everything with the Cabal. I think it's just some really, really interesting stuff.
Oh, definitely. I just don't like John Grammaticus.
But we see Eldred here too, eh?
Yeah,
Eldred talks to Vulcan and talks to Grammaticus, I think.
And he's got his own objectives.
So that's interesting. Not all the Eldar on board with what the Cabal are doing.
Well, that's probably good, because Eldred's awesome.
But he's not in this. He talks to Vulcan a bit, and I think it's actually, I think I'm confused, because I think it's in Unremembered Empire when he talks to Grammaticus.
Yeah, like, that's when he shows himself to Grammaticus, and he's like, hey, like, you shouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Yeah, that's the point of the B story. The B story has no payoff in this. The B story is all setting up what happens next. And then you have, again, everybody's fighting over this the lightning spear. You have Grammaticus, which essentially tricks the salamanders into helping him. You have, so they can try to kill Vulcan. And then you have Narek. Narek, which is a really cool word bearer character that is not, I guess he was missed in the cull.
Yeah. Wasn't he, don't they mention him in Fear?
Narek?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
I'm pretty sure he's mentioned in it. But anyway, yeah, they didn't call him properly.
So they missed him, and now he's a traitor to his legion. So Narek, and this is another thing I think you only find out in Unremembered Empire, Narek figures out what the spear's for, and he decides he's going to steal it to kill Lorgar.
Yeah.
So this whole thing trying to get the spear, this continues on into Unremembered Empire. So once again, this is best understood as the first of a two-parter. Like, at the end of this book, it's to be continued. And thankfully, they didn't wait, like, 10 years to put out Unremembered Empire. They come out back-to-back, so, I mean, that's not too much of a problem. It's not like the end of the second Dark Angels book. It's like, how long do we have to wait to find out what's the conclusion of this story? But what did you think of what did you think of the B story?
It was pretty good. I just didn't like how it ended for Numian. But I guess it's all setting up for what happens in Unremembered Empire. So it was necessary.
Absolutely. And, okay, one thing I really appreciate is this whole question of weapons. You have to strengthen your own weapons and damage the enemies.
Yeah.
Like Erebus keeps using this sort of idea that you have to, and for the whole book, you think it's the spear, right? You have to get more weapons and you got to deny the weapons to your enemy. But you find out at the end that it's the Primarchs. And this comes all down to how Erebus is actually like looking at the war, right? Because that was the whole point of Cygnus Prime. So this is all a theme of the Primarchs being the weapons of this war, which I think is a theme that goes through all these books. I mean, it's a fratricidal war. Yeah, I think it's really cool. It also reinforces something that I keep mentioning, and I think I keep getting flack for, and that's the question of the sort of factions within the traitor cause, because Erebus mentions it quite clearly that he's seen Horus resist the Pantheon, and Erebus is doing his own thing.
Yeah.
I think Erebus mentioned it pretty clearly that he sees himself as the architect of the war, and Horus for him is a patsy. And he hates the fact that Horus is trying to do his own thing, trying to run the war himself. So I think there are really two minor factions that are both trying to control the flow of things. And Erebus got corrected by getting his face cut off, but he's not done. This whole ploy with trying, you know, helping the Cabal kill Vulcan, that's all Erebus. That's another one of Erebus's little plots. But I think on a second reading, I actually really enjoyed the B story, all the stuff going on. When I read it the first time, I thought it was useless. It's just like, why do you have to stick in the Shattered Legions in this book? It makes no sense.
Yeah.
But now that I reread it and I'm looking at it as a whole with Unremembered Empire, I actually really like Vulcan Lives, and I really like that particular story. And I think it fits in really well with the whole theme of, well, essentially Vulcan Lives, you know, like that theme of the Primarch of, what's the point of the Salamander's Primarch in this? Like, what's going to happen to him? Mm-hmm. It's all a fight for what's going to happen to the Salamander's Primarch. It's all a fight. This whole book is about what happens to Vulcan. And this is concluded in Unremembered Empire, of course. But I think the two stories work together now. At first time, I didn't think the two stories worked together, and I thought it was useless. I felt that it should have been two books.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that just shows that, you know, you can be wrong and change your mind about some things.
Yep.
okay, so let's go. Let's move into the A story. We'll be going back and forth a lot, but I think we can start talking about Vulcan on the Nightfall.
Okay.
As much as this is a story about Vulcan, I think it's just as much a story about Kurz, because you learn a lot about his personality.
Mm-hmm.
He's a broken, self-loathing man.
Yeah.
Primarch. God man. Before we get into Kurz, actually, I think we should probably talk about the dominant theme, and this is actually relevant to talking about Kurz. The dominant theme of this entire book is guilt. If there's one dominant thing that comes through everything, like all the characters, like a lot of the characters, not all the characters, but a lot of the characters are dealing with guilt. But yeah, Vulcan, that he's guilty about a bunch of stuff, and that's what's really like damaging him, and that's where Kurz is really like, you know, sticking the knife in.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Numion, You have the fact that he couldn't save his one of his favorite sons, I suppose. What makes him feel so guilty about what happened to Nguyen on his Event 5? What is it that makes him feel so guilty? Because what happened exactly?
On his Event 5?
Yeah. Like, he died in his arms?
It's not Nguyen that died in his arm. It's someone else. Okay. You want to grab the list of characters?
Nemator.
Yeah.
Oh, those are two different characters.
Yeah.
Ah, damn it. You're right. Okay, so yeah, you're right. It is. Okay, those are two different characters. I got them confused, almost, Nemator and Nguyen. So it's Nemator that dies on his Event 5.
Well, he's gravely wounded.
But he survives?
Yeah, remember, he's in one of the traps in the...
I thought that was an illusion. God damn it. Yeah, you're right. And Numion's on in the B story. I thought that was the same character in that he survived Istvan 5 and he winds up on that planet.
Yeah, because okay. Numion's one of the Pyre Guard.
Okay, I gotcha. So what happened to Nemator?
Well, in the Istvan, he was gravely wounded. And Vulcan gets surrounded by the traitors and kills scores of them before they manage to drag Nemator from his arms and then eventually beat him down.
Okay. Why does he feel so guilty about the fact that Nemator died? Like, his legion was crippled. I mean, probably like 50, 60,000 salamanders were killed.
Yeah.
Why this one? Is it just him that just represents the what happened? Does he, like, represent to Vulcan all his sons?
It might be, because he could have, like, we know now at the end, he could have teleported it away at any moment with his hammer, but he stayed to protect him.
So is that why he didn't use the hammer to get out of Istvan 5?
It makes perfect, like, at first I thought it was stupid. He could have just got away, but it really shows his character. You know, he's not going to give up defending his sons and his brothers and, you know, humanity.
Because when you said when we did Unrealm Empire, it's like, why didn't he use his hammer to get out of the drop site massacre? But yeah, you're right. He probably wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't have abandoned his sons.
Like, everyone around him was dead except for this one guy who's mortally wounded. He was going to defend him with his life.
So yeah, that's his primary guilt. But there's other things. Like, again, this is the primary, like, emotional core of this book is Vulcan's guilt for a bunch of stuff. There's also, and this one I don't like as much, because the whole thing with Nemator is awesome, but he feels guilty about killing, like, an Eldar child.
Yeah.
And, like, well, burning it to death.
Yeah.
Sending an Eldar child on fire. But it's a dirty Xenos breed. It's a Xenos witch. Why does he feel so bad?
Because it's still just a child.
I don't know. I like that one a little less. If it was a human child, I don't know. It would have been a stronger for me. But the fact that it was an Eldar.
It's probably just showing his compassion for life, even if it is a Xenos thing. It's still a child, and it's innocent. But, I mean, it really wasn't innocent, but you know what I mean?
So, yeah, okay, yeah, I get you. I guess that maybe is actually a strong narrative choice to have a Xenos child. Well, yeah, so he feels guilty about that one. And the whole thing is, I like to call this book the reverse Batman. Nick Kime pulled a reverse Batman.
Okay.
Because you know how Kurz is space Batman?
Yeah.
Well, in this particular case, he's pulling a Joker.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the interesting things, because one of the things that one of the dominant things that the Joker does is try to prove that Batman is just like him.
Yeah.
You know, he tries to turn Batman into him, trying to break him. And you see this in the movie The Dark Knight, which itself borrowed, I think, the theme from several old stories, particularly the classic Joker story, The Killing Joke. And he's not read The Killing Joke, go pick up the trade paperback. It's available everywhere. It's just amazing. And in The Killing Joke, essentially the whole goal of the story is the Joker's trying to show that all it takes is one bad day to make that anybody would turn into him, turn into the Joker. He can make anybody go insane or turn into him. And he's trying to prove, and in this particular case, he pretty much tries to break Jim Gordon by crippling Barbara Gordon. Anyways, this isn't a comic book podcast.
But yeah.
Essentially, the Joker keeps trying to break Batman. And that's why a lot of the time the Joker tries to get Batman to kill him. And that's, like, one of his goals. If Batman kills the Joker, then the Batman is no different than the Joker. And this is sort of like, this theme is also present in Vulcan Lives. I'm not saying it's lifted from comic books, but it's a similar theme. And since we keep talking about Kurz being essentially the Night Haunter is sort of like an evil Batman, like a more extreme Batman. And so I think like the reverse Batman on this, having him trying to prove that Vulcan is just like him, I think it's really interesting. It stuck out to me.
Yeah.
But that's the whole goal. That's Kurz's goal at the end of the day, though. Kurz's goal isn't to kill Vulcan. It's to sort of, and throughout the whole time, even during the Great Crusade, is to show that, you know, all of Vulcan's humanity is a mask. If at the end of the day, they're all the same. They're all killers. They're all murderers.
Yeah.
And I think that comes to a head at the end of the book, where Kurz is essentially begging Vulcan to kill him. It says, not only will this prove that Vulcan's a murderer like him, but, you know, it'll also end his pain. Because that's all he wants is vindication, you know. He wants the vindication of knowing that everybody's like him, that he's not alone, he's not this one pathetic, broken individual, that all of them are pathetic and broken. That's sort of what all Conrad wants to prove. And eventually the Emperor gives him that. Good job, Emperor. Or actually, it wouldn't be the Emperor. It'd be the Sigilite, right?
The High Lords.
The High Lords, yeah. They're the ones who sanction his
yeah, the Sigilite's dead at that point.
Okay. But anyways, so that's what the Imperium gives him finally. Gives him his final vindication. But Vulcan refuses to give him that. And I think that's a really, really strong part in the book, too. I love that whole scene with Kurz essentially begging. And then you have Vulcan. It's like, no matter, even with all the stuff that Kurz did to me, I still pity him.
Yeah.
And that tells you, I still love the Night Haunter. I actually like him even more with this. Even his patheticness makes me like him even more. He's just such an interesting character. So how does... maybe we could talk about Kurz's torture dungeon.
Oh, yes, the dungeon.
Because how is he going to do this? How is he going to break Vulcan? Vulcan's already guilty, so all you need to... Already feeling guilty about a bunch of stuff, so you just need to twist the knife on him. But first of all, Kurz tries to break his body.
Yeah.
And that's when he discovers that he can't die. And here's another question I had, just as an aside. Does Vulcan die on Istvan 5?
Maybe they just they figured he was unconscious or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, maybe it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. But Kurz eventually realizes that Vulcan can't die, and so he just keeps inventing new scenarios to try to break his body. So he starts by tricking him to thinking he's escaped or something like that, and blowing him out in space.
Yeah.
So, which, by the way, this is another one. Okay. I just thought of something. Vulcan died. The Vulcan, the strongest of all the Primarchs, the most resilient of all the Primarchs, dies when he gets blown out into space. And yet Bob Gulliman does not, after being out there for like 8 hours. Huh? You know, I said that was a silly scene?
Yeah.
Vulcan can't even do it. How come Gulliman can?
Because the ship had a small amount of atmosphere.
No, don't give me that shit. Don't give me that shit. I love all these books, but I'm not afraid to call them out for some things that I don't like. I'm a person of honesty and in intellectual integrity, and that scene made no sense. Anyways.
Okay.
So he starts by blasting him, by freezing Vulcan. That doesn't work, so then he ties him to a reactor.
Turns on the reactor.
Yeah. So then he fries him. And I love that scene, too, with Ferris. Like, he keeps seeing... he's like haunted by the ghost of Ferris Manus, and Ferris Manus is just like laughing as he melts.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool. So that doesn't work. So eventually he realizes he can't break Vulcan's body. So he tries to break his mind. And that's the second part. And then he starts, you know, just doing really ingenious traps. So first of all, the basic labyrinth, it's the Iron Labyrinth, and it was built by Perturabo, my boy Perturabo. And I like how they keep talking about how amazing a craftsman Perturabo is.
Yeah.
It builds upon what we learned from Angel Exterminatus. And I remember this as I reread it. They do mention this, the Iron Labyrinth. They mention it in Angel Exterminatus.
Yeah.
Because remember, it mentions that Perturabo built two. He built one for himself and he built one for his brother. And that's the labyrinth that they're keeping Vulcan in. Which I guess is what you need to hold a Primarch.
Pretty much, yeah.
And on Terra, they built a cell for Horus. Come on. Like an ingenious forensic labyrinth couldn't hold Vulcan, and you think you're going to hold Horus in a cell?
Yeah, it's okay. You know, some bars and stuff. He'll be held captive.
So, but anyways, so he's been held in, and you know, Kurz is having fun with a bunch of fun traps, and a bunch of fun torture devices.
Yep.
So instead of going through all of them, what's your favorite? What's your favorite of all of these?
My favorite was the supper.
The supper?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was cool. That was awesome. You want to describe it?
Basically, Vulcan has to watch as people are brought in that have no hands, no eyes, and have a nice banquet in front of them.
Kurz has designed it so that, you know, they have knives and forks essentially, like, attached to the stumps where their other hands are being moved.
Yeah.
And they're, like, tied to chairs, and there's, like, a sumptuous banquet in front of them. But they can't... he's designed it so that they can't get the food into their mouths. And then Vulcan starts yelling, "Feed each other!" And then it turns out that they're blind and deaf.
Yeah.
So he has to watch, since, you know, Primarchs don't die, and these are just a bunch of mortals around a table. He has to watch them starve to death in front of, like, rotting food.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was pretty cool. That was lovely.
How about yourself?
My favorite is the giant slab.
Oh yes.
The big slab of Kurz put a bunch of humans. Once again, he tortures and kills humans to try to break Vulcan's brain, because Vulcan, you know, cares about saving humanity. He's the only one that truly believes that his role is to help humanity. And so he's tied Vulcan to one end. Well, he's not really tied to it, but essentially there's this big slab and there's a bunch of people underneath, and Vulcan has to hold up the slab or else the people die.
Yeah.
And then eventually, like, you know, he holds it up as long as he can, but eventually, like, his strength, he gets weak enough that he drops the slab and all the people just get crushed and die. Probably die instantly, though.
Doesn't he slowly drop it, though? Like, he's struggling so hard and they slowly get crushed to death?
No, I think in the last few feet, he just dropped it completely, which is the merciful thing to do.
Okay.
I don't know. Honestly, he should have known that there was no way out, so instead of prolonging their suffering, he should have just dropped it right away.
Probably, but that's
not what Vulcan does. He will do everything possible to save a life. But yeah, I thought that was... I think in all of these torture scenes, I think Nick Keim does a fantastic job of describing it, because you wind up with some really haunting scenes that are really well described, like some nice details that actually make the whole thing particularly gruesome. Like when you're describing all the people that are under the block, you have a couple of them that are trying to hold the thing up, but they can't. A couple of, like, families that are sobbing together because they don't want to die alone, and you have one guy in the corner who just accepts his fate. And, I mean, these details are really, really, really haunting, and I think it does a great job. And especially when you see them, and this is where the first person, the strength of the decision to use the first person narrative or narration with Vulcan is really strong, because it shows that the horror that he's feeling at that moment of seeing these things.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool. Those are my favorite. But there's a couple other good ones there. The one where he thinks he's fighting Korax, which is another really cool one, because I really believed it. I really thought Korax came to save him. I shouldn't have, you know, after everything that happened before, but yeah, he gets broken pretty, he gets broken good. All in all, is there anything else we really need to talk about this book?
No, not really. I have one question for you, though.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when they're doing flashbacks to Istvan 5, and you're like, sweet, Angron's going to fight Vulcan, and he calls him High Rider. What does he mean by that?
The High Rider?
Yeah.
A High Rider, those are the people that, on his planet.
The
High Riders are the, like, the slave masters.
Oh, okay, cool.
Those are the Romans. Since he's Space Spartacus, the Space Romans are the High Riders.
Okay, I gotcha. I didn't catch that. Neat.
Yeah. And that actually reminds me, there's two other things that I want to mention real quick. We should have talked about this when we were talking about the B story, but I forgot. There's the reason, I guess the importance of this book and where this fits in the greater story of the Horus Heresy is essentially trying to figure out what's going to happen with Vulcan. Like, what's Vulcan's role going to be in the Heresy? And there's something that keeps coming up, is that he's the gatekeeper.
Okay.
And... You have the ruinous powers. You have the traitors that want to remove the. You can't have Vulcan as the gatekeeper, and you have people like Eldrad, and you have essentially, you know, the loyalists that are. I think it's Eldrad pretty much that mentions it, and says he has to be the gatekeeper if the Heresy is for the loyalists to win. What do you think that means, that Vulcan is the gatekeeper?
I really don't know, to be honest. Do you have any ideas?
I think maybe Lion's Gate.
Oh, okay.
That's my theory. I might be wrong about this, but I think that might be what they mean by him being the gatekeeper, in that if he's on Terra, like maybe the Emperor doesn't die or something like that. Maybe that's what they mean by the gatekeeper. Maybe they mean Lionsgate spaceport.
Okay. Well, it makes sense. It makes sense.
Because that gets to, I think Sanguinius defeats... That's where Sanguinius counterattacks, eh? Sanguinius is holding the Lion's Gate.
When he defeats Kabanda for the second time?
Yeah. When he breaks his back?
Yeah.
I think that's at Lion's Gate, so maybe... I don't know, maybe that's what Vulcan's role is. Maybe if Vulcan's on Terra, then the traitors don't get as far as they do. Or maybe there's another... I don't know. I don't know what the gate is. That's just a thought I have.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that's what this book is for. It's to talk about what happens with Vulcan, because if Vulcan is on the Loyalist side, the Loyalists are probably going to win the war. And if he's out of action, well, the traitors have a much better chance.
Okay, cool.
So I'm not sure. But listeners out there, if anybody has any theories as to what they mean by theories, or maybe we actually know, maybe I'm just being an idiot. If anybody knows what Vulcan as the gatekeeper means, let us know. I really want to know. I'm not sure about this one. There's a couple of things with the Primarchs that we could talk about. I don't think there's that much more I want to talk about. Oh, just a quick thing. You know, we keep making fun of Gollum, and I forgot that Conrad Kurz does too. He calls him the war accountant.
Really?
Conrad Kurz calls Gollum the war accountant who fights his battles with an abacus.
Nice.
So I think that's actually, that's really, really cool. You keep calling him a space bureaucrat, but I guess the war accountant is just as good. That's another thing I wanted to mention real quick. I think that's good.
Cool.
That's just one I wanted to throw out there. I'm sorry if for those that that don't like us not liking Gulliman.
Oh, but you don't care.
We're not gonna change our minds on Gulliman.
Yeah, you
not after care. All these years. So I think that's good for Vulcan Lives, and I think after this, it's time to finally do what we promised and move into Unremembered Empire Part 2.
All right, let's do it.
So in 2 weeks, we're finally going to deal with all the myriad comments we've had on Unremembered Empire. We're going to look at it again, and we're going to see if our opinions on it changed. Because if you recall in the first episode, we did not like it. And so I'm really, really pumped about reading it right after Vulcan Lives, because I didn't do it the first time. I read them out of order, as I mentioned before. So I'm going to read Unremembered Empire, and I'm going to see if my opinions on it has changed. And we're going to deal with all the comments that we've had about it. So that's gonna be a big one. That's gonna be a big episode. But we've promised we're gonna do it. And honestly, down the line, we're probably gonna revisit all of these books that we've talked about, because we receive a lot of comments, and I think it's worth talking about.
Definitely.
Okay, so in 2 weeks, Unremembered Empire again.
Unremembered Empire Redux.
Redux. More thoughts on Unremembered Empire. Let's do that. More thoughts on Unremembered Empire.
Wicked.
Awesome. Okay, so that's locked in. I think that's good for book club. Actually, before we jump into the 2 week hobby challenges and the end of the show, I did want to. We did get one piece of feedback from the False Gods episode we did 2 weeks ago that I'd like to address, because it's another little mistake that we made, and we do not shy away from our mistakes. We got an email from Marcus, who says, first, I wanted to say thanks for your podcast. I really enjoy listening to your mix of news, hobby, and gaming, and especially the book reviews that you do. I'm a geek for the Heresy lore, but don't actually play the game, so having the reviews keeps me coming back each episode. Awesome. You see, there's a lot of people who are more into the hobbying and the story and all that stuff. That's what I love the best, so great to hear. Okay. Quote, I just wanted to give you a little feedback on an error in your coverage. You made reference to Hastur Sejanus being the former equerry to Horus. This isn't the case. Malagurus was the equerry all along, as far as we know. And Sejanus was simply company captain and member of the Morn of All. Love your coverage of the swamp battles on Davin's Moon. I, too, had not realized it involved plague bearers. Yeah, I totally didn't notice that.
I just thought it was zombies.
Yeah. Keep up the good work. Cheers, Marcus. Thanks, bud. You were totally right. Sejanus was just a company captain. He was not Horus's equerry. I don't know why I thought he was. I think it's just because he's Horus's favorite. I just had the impression that he was the equerry.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah. Well, anyways, thank you for correcting us, Marcus. It's really appreciated. And once again, anybody else who finds mistakes, please let us know. Help us get out of our ignorance, you know? We want to get this right, so don't be shy about letting us know when we make mistakes like this. All
there's
right,
also a ton of lore.
Yeah, there's a lot to know, and we try to be as knowledgeable as possible, but we're never going to know all of this. I mean, there's just a ton.
Where's the fun in that, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. So thanks for letting us know. If there's anything else, if we make, I think we can go to the end part now. So that'll do it for Book Club. All right, we're back for the 2 week hobby challenge. Mark,
hooray.
What was your 2 week hobby challenge?
To finish my Malkador.
All right, that's a solid challenge. My 2 week hobby challenge was to finish 10 Imperialist Militia troopers. As I said before, you know, do high. They were already kind of painted, but not very well. So I added highlights. I fixed some dings on them because they're old metal models. I fixed them. I was supposed to fix them up. So I was supposed to do 10 of them. Next up was Philip, who was a painting machine. He was supposed to finish 17 of the Alpha Legionaries he had primed for the last two-week hobby challenge. And lastly, our other dear listener who joined us for the two-week hobby challenge was Shane, who said he was going to paint the Night Haunter Conrad Kurz. So yeah, he's supposed to do Conrad Kurz in 2 weeks. Now that is quite the challenge. I don't know if I could do a Primarch in 2 weeks. But we already had Zach who did Dulliman. Do you think you could paint a Primarch in 2 weeks?
Probably. I just don't know how satisfied I'd be with it because I'm not sure how much time I'd have to spend on.
Yeah. Well, anyways. Okay. So let's see how everybody did. Mark, did you finish your Malkador?
I finished my Malkador, and it looked like a pile of shit. So it's in simple green.
What happened?
Well, you know, I recently got an airbrush, right?
Yeah.
And I've been doing a little bit of airbrushing here, spraying my Sigmar Marines, you know, gold, and doing some base coats here and there. And then I'm like, well, I got the hang of this thing. I'm going to go to town on my Malkador. And it looked like a bright red pile of shit.
What'd you do?
I didn't mix any of the paints I had. So I was going layers from, like, I was trying to basically sort of brighten it up a bit. And I just went from one color to another color, so like straight from a red to an orange to a yellow, and it looked awful.
Oh yeah, you have to mix your paints a little bit.
Yeah, it's like I got the hang of this. I can do this, and no, it looked like a pile of crap. So it's in simple green.
Oh man, that sucks.
Yep.
I feel your pain.
Yeah.
You know what that means, though?
It means I'm finally in the box of shame.
It finally happened. Now you can be in the box and feel shame. How does shame feel, Mark? How does it feel, the shame?
I feel really bad. I'm disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, that's how I feel week after week. But you know what? Not this week. Because I painted my 10 guys.
Wicked.
So yeah, just a couple touch-ups to do there, and I got to seal them. But we already said that I'm not counting sealing. It's not going to get done anytime soon. But I did what I said I was going to do. Finished up my guys.
Wicked.
So I'm actually pretty happy about that. So now I got my full 20-man Imperialist militia squad, and now I've got to now I just got to try to finish this allied detachment so I can get back to doing some Iron Warriors. Okay, so let's see how everybody else did. So Philip, he had to do his 17 legionaries, got him done, looked great as usual. Man, that guy, 17 men in 2 weeks. I don't think I could do it.
You can do it. Come on.
Yeah, no, the guy's got a good work ethic. But well done, Philip, as usual. Great job. And there was also Shane with his Night Haunter. He got it done right under the wire, too. Right under the wire. While we were recording the show, I got his email with his pictures from the Night Haunter. Good thing I checked.
Wicked.
Right under the wire, Shane. Well done. Your Night Haunter's awesome. I'm going to be posting pictures of your finished Conrad Kurz and the rest of your Primarchs and characters, your Rogues Gallery. I was supposed to do it before, but I'll do it this week. I'll post all that stuff on Facebook. Just great, great job. Great work. I'm very impressed by everybody. And for once, I'm not the one that disgraces our show, Mark.
Now,
you're the one who disgraces our show. No, I'm just joking. No, it sucks. It happened to me, too, a little while ago.
Yeah, just sometimes it just happens, and on a model like that, you don't want it to look like crap, so.
Yeah. So, that's not the end of the world there. You're still winning this one hands down if we're competing. I don't think we're competing, but it's really just about shame. Okay,
it's still cold.
Pardon?
It's still cold and dark in here right now, and lonely.
And lonely? Yeah. Well, it's 2 minutes by yourself. 2 minutes by yourself, and then you are free. Unless someone scores a goal, in which case you can leave.
Wicked.
Okay, so for the next 2 week hobby challenge, what are you going to try to get done?
Well, it's in the simple green. I got to leave it in there for a little while so I can get all the paint off.
Yeah.
So I'll probably have a chance to get it out, reprime it, and start working on some of the colors again.
Okay. That sounds fair. How far along do you think you want to be in 2 weeks?
Probably want to just get, I don't know. I can't really say because I don't want to rush it. So I want to get maybe a third to half done.
Oh, I wasn't thinking of a percentage. I mean, like you want to get the red on, I figure.
Yeah, I'm going to get the red on and potentially try redoing some of the layers on it.
Yeah. In the meantime, why don't you practice with your airbrush? That can be a part of your 2 week hobby challenge.
That's what I've been doing actually with my Sigmarine. So.
Oh, cool. All right. Perfect. Okay, that's locked in. I will attempt to finish. I'm going to attempt to finish my 2 Lehman Russes that I started a while back because I wanted to get some products, like some winter streaking fluid. I can't find anybody that sells it around here. So if I can't find it in the next, because I don't want this to sit around half painted and not sealed. So if I can't find the AK Interactive product I need, the winter streaking grime, I'm gonna go to the hobby store in Ottawa when I'm out of Ottawa. I'm going to try to, I think they have it. But if not, I'm just going to finish it up. And somewhere down the line, I might do some more layers in it. But I'm going to finish the weathering of my Lehman Russes. It's actually a big job. I'm going to try to weather the hell out of them.
Wicked.
So that's going to be me. That's going to be my 2 Lehman Russes. And the other reason I want this as my 2 week hobby challenge is I got to travel. I got to travel with them, and I don't want all the weathering to come off in my battle foam case, like come off on the foam.
Yeah.
So the thing's got to be finished and sealed before I leave town, before I leave for my trip. So that's my 2 week hobby challenge. Finish the weathering on my 2 Lehman Russes. Next up, Philip, as usual, sent us has his 2 week hobby challenge. He will be finishing what he calls something small, but I think it's a pretty big job. He wants to find a Death Guard Rhino to find a proper painting scheme for the Death Guard car park. So he's going to finish a Rhino and a Death Guard Praetorian.
Wicked.
And already Death Guard Praetorian's already, he's already working on it, so I have no doubt he'll be able to get that done. And then our friend Graham. So Graham will be attempting to finish 7 Unification Wars veterans. Just really cool conversions using Chaos Warrior bits and a bunch of other stuff. They look really, really cool. So there's Space Wolves, or Vilka Fenrika if you prefer. So he's going to try to get that done in the next 2 weeks. And once again, for the 2 week hobby challenges, we were kind of lazy with them in the last month. I mean, we weren't really, with the whole vacation and everything else that wound up happening, we weren't taking care of posting the 2 week hobby challenges too much, of posting the 2 week hobby challenges. But that's over. We're gonna start every 2 weeks. If you send us a 2 week hobby challenge, you get it done. We're definitely gonna throw that on a photo album on the Facebook page. So we're gonna try to get a little more serious with that now that there's interest in joining us. So those are the 2 week hobby challenges for this next fortnight.
So JP, what song are you gonna play this time?
Oh, I think I got a good one. So since this is a song about Conrad Kurz's ship. It's called It's called Madhouse by Anthrax.
Ooh, wicked.
Because the refrain is it's a madhouse, and that's sort of what I see Conrad Kurz's ship becoming.
Yeah.
So I think that's an appropriate one. Plus, you know, I haven't played much thrash in the last couple weeks, so I'm gonna throw that in there. So from some Anthrax.
Let's do it.
Which is a lot of fun. Okay, I think that's good for the show. Once again, check out our Battlecast and let us know what you think. And there should be, before our next episode in 2 weeks, there should be another Battlecast coming out, we hope. And in 2 weeks, we're going to continue our discussion of Conquest. And we will be also revisiting Unrimmered Empire. So I'm looking forward to that one. That should be interesting.
Definitely.
All right. So once again, I'm JP.
And I am the humbled Mark.
And thanks for listening.
Mr. Brown.